moving back to New York from Hong Kong at the end of 1980. My life as a resident of Hong Kong lasted a little more than 6 months. At the end of 1980, Ernst Brutscher resigned from Citibank. He had been in charge of foreign exchange and money market trading for North America, including Canada, in New York. Don Howard called me and offered me the opportunity to succeed Ernst, and so I moved back to New York. This was good for everybody. I was reunited with my family and had less business-related travel. The job was a big one, actually the biggest line job I ever had. Family life, 1978 to 1983. Life in Darien continued to be good. We enjoyed our new house on Stephanie Lane. One of the neighbors organized Christmas caroling, which we all enjoyed. Janine, at age 8 and 9, was usually sitting on the back of another neighbor, Bill Maple. Bill was a senior vice president at Citibank in domestic banking, but I never had much prior contact with him. In addition to my parents and son Heinz, there were repeated visits from Ingrid's nephews and a longtime skiing friend of Ingrid, Walter Paulus. I resumed actively playing tennis at the country club of Darien. I won the tennis singles club championship in 1974 and 1975, but did not compete in 1976 and 1977 because I had been living in the Philippines. I made a special effort to win that championship again in 1978 at the age of 42. My competitors were young kids in their early 20s. The 1978 finals were scheduled on a weekend when I was committed during the prior week to teach at the Citibank Middle East Training Center in Athens, and soon after that weekend in Geneva for CEI. Athens was a Citibank event, and Geneva was not Citibank. It was my own private teaching activity. It would be perfectly acceptable to collect an airfare for trips to New York from both Citibank and CEI, which would make it possible for me to fly back from Athens on a Friday, play the club championship over the weekend, and then fly to Geneva to teach my executive seminar from Wednesday to Friday. It was a little tight, but I had lost some weight, taken some lessons from the pro, and trained for this 1978 club championship event. I badly wanted to win that club championship one more time. It worked, and I was happy. So I won that title in 1974 and 1975, and again in 1978. The three trophies have a special place in my house. My marital relationship with Ingrid began to suffer. The frequent travel did not help, and there were other reasons as well. Citibank demanded a lot of my time, including evening activities with customers. I decided to buy a small condo in Manhattan on 79th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. It was a wonderful one-bedroom condo with a wood-burning fireplace, and still in comfortable walking distance to my office at 399 Park Avenue and 53rd Street. I began to think about a divorce, but I could not bring myself to take that step. The way I was brought up in the 1950s, people just would not divorce. One would just somehow continue to get along, largely because of the children. And I already had one divorce. My thinking was that never mind how successful I might be in my business life, with two divorces, I would be an outcast. So Ingrid and I just continued to live our lives without having much in common. Ralph was diagnosed with a learning disability and dyslexia. We sent him to Eagle Hill in Hardwick, Massachusetts, which was a special school designed for bright, capable students experiencing academic difficulties because of a specific learning disability. The school was only about 2 hours away from Darian, so we could visit him from time to time, or he could come home for long weekends and holidays. The important thing is that the school was very good for him. He still has a little difficulty reading fast and writing. However, he has that in common with Nelson Rockefeller, President Nixon, and ex-Citibank chairman John Reed, who all had exactly the same problem and did well in life. The same is true for Ralph. He graduated successfully from Darien High School, and after that, from Babson College in Boston. At Babson, students gain an entrepreneurial mindset necessary to achieve their goals and make an impact on their careers. Janine went to a nearby Connecticut boarding school, and later to the Knox School in St. James, Long Island, which is a dynamic and diverse community that fosters personal and intellectual growth. Janine graduated from Knox with her high school degree, and after that, went on to Pine Manor College near Boston. Pine Manor's mission is committed to educating and empowering a diverse student body with the knowledge and skills they will need to meet the challenges of career, community, and citizenship in today's global society. As the years went by, my relationship with Ingrid continued to deteriorate. I found myself staying more often in my apartment in the city. We became de facto separated in 1983 and ultimately divorced in 1984. Ingrid had custody of Ralph, and I had custody of Janine, and both Janine and I were happy with that. I paid alimony for Ingrid to maintain the lifestyle to which she was accustomed. After a couple of years, Ingrid told me that she wanted to open a restaurant. She proposed to capitalize my monthly payments. This meant that I would no longer pay a monthly amount. Instead, I would pay one large amount one time and thereafter have no more obligations to her. I agreed to this and paid her the equivalent of 4 years' alimony. It turned out that she never opened a restaurant. Instead, she married her ex-boyfriend and ski instructor, Walter Paulus, a few months later. My life in Citibank, beginning 1981. When I returned from Hong Kong, the first good news I had after arriving at Citibank New York in the new year was that I got the same wonderful office that Ernst Brutscher had occupied, the corner office, on the 6th floor on Park Avenue and 53rd Street. It was very large and offered a great view south towards the Pan Am Building and Grand Central Station. I kept that wonderful office almost until my retirement at the end of 1995. See photo below. I had responsibility for interbank and corporate foreign exchange and offshore US dollar, euro dollar, trading for Citibank Nassau. That is the offshore funding center that I had created in 1970, 11 years prior. This was a big job. I had about 200 people reporting to me. The Nassau funding center had grown into a huge profit center. Corporate FX was something I had created some years ago. Now, the FX dealing room was divided into two areas, corporate and interbank. When the phone rang in the interbank section, traders knew that it was another bank calling, such as Chase or Bank of America. When the phone rang in the corporate FX section, traders knew that it was a customer calling, such as IBM or Coca-Cola. The interbank trading was highly professional and fast. The corporate FX trading was much slower. Traders would talk to customers about what was happening in the market, interpretation of the latest news, etc. This division between interbank and corporate FX again was a first. I had instituted it, and it worked. The volume of our corporate FX business was growing. Another thing I created at the time was an overnight FX desk where customers could call after business hours. This overnight desk was immensely profitable. We found that otherwise tough customers who would drive a hard bargain to get the best rate were less difficult to deal with in the evening or at night. It was either that they were not in the office environment anymore, or it may have been that they already had a drink. Who knows? The fact is that we were making a lot of money on that overnight desk. The entire FX area was headed by Jim Wiseman. His deputy was Rich Mahoney. Rich thought that he should be in charge of FX and not Jim Wiseman. That rivalry began to disturb and negatively impact the performance of the entire foreign exchange department. On my first day on the job in January 1981, my boss, Don Howard, told me that I had to solve that problem and decide who would be the boss for the future. I knew immediately that they were both very good, but I also knew that Jim Wiseman was better. I just did not have the courage to tell Rich. Giving Rich what he had to perceive as bad news was made even more difficult for me because I knew that Rich's wife was pregnant and that there were some serious medical problems. I understood that the baby needed heart surgery before being born. Weeks went by, and periodically Don Howard would ask me whether I had decided on the leadership of the FX department. Finally, Don told me if I did not do it this week, he would make the decision for me. I could not allow that to happen. It would have been a slap in my face and indicate that I could not manage a large profit center like the one I was heading, and that I was not able to make a tough decision. I thought about the problem intensely and came up with a great, nearly Solomonic solution. Treasury meant the combination of FX and money market business. Traders had to be able to trade foreign currency rates and interest rates, yet most traders were familiar with only one type of trading, either FX or interest rates. That was particularly true for Citibank New York, because both areas, FX and interest rates, were so very large. Rich Mahoney was an FX trader and knew little about interest rates. Also, the Chicago Futures Exchange had just started trading a futures contract for euro-dollar interest rates. In fact, my good friend Tom Bergen, who was running the offshore Nassau desk, was looking for someone to fill that futures trading job. I talked to Tom Bergen, described the dilemma I faced with Rich Mahoney, and Tom agreed to give Rich the new job of trading euro-dollar interest rate futures. Here is the birthday letter of Tom Bergen, former managing director of Citibank New York.
Hi Janine, here are a few anecdotes which may add some colour to the book you are preparing. Business humour. In either 1981 or 1982, when your dad was responsible for foreign exchange, treasury and corporate counselling, and of course the large trading room on the 7th floor at 399, his direct reports took him out to lunch for his birthday. Unbeknownst to me, the other three guys had arranged for a singing telegram to come to the trading room for when we returned from lunch. Upon returning to the trading room, which was quite large and packed with traders, your dad stood at the FX desk when a very large woman in a bright red dress approached him and said in a loud and high-pitched voice, "Are you Mr. Real?" Now, most people at that point would have realised that something was up and would either have headed for the hills or would have turned beet red. As if this woman could have been just a normal visitor to the dealing room, your dad simply said, "Yes," expecting her to announce her business. At that point, she began singing Happy Birthday in a loud voice and, while singing, bumping her behind with his behind to the beat of the song. After completing the song, she took her bright red mouth, just caked with red lipstick, and kissed your dad on the mouth. When she finished, he had this large red mark all around his mouth. He looked like a famous clown from the circus. The trading room was in an uproar. I had a visitor standing at my desk who could not restrain his laughter. Your dad, of course, took all of this with his usual good sense of humour. Another senior vice president, not on the trading floor at the time, having heard of this experience, instructed his secretary to guarantee that this would never happen to him. Again, in the early 80s, your dad was interviewing for a new secretary. While I was in his office, he placed a call to a potential candidate. It was clear that the person who answered was not this person, and this candidate was out of the office. Your dad instructed the person on the phone to advise the candidate that he had called. As he always did, he said, "Tell her that Heinz Riehl called. That's R-I-E-H-L, L as in London." The next thing I hear him say is, "No, I'm not calling from London. I spelt my name. Just give her the message." Your dad and I had lunch one day in a Swiss restaurant, which was located in Citicorp Center. At the conclusion of lunch, I wanted a coffee. Your dad wanted an espresso and a Sambuca, and he, also, wanted the waiter to bring the check. He instructed the waiter to bring me the coffee, bring him the espresso and the Sambuca, and the check. Only your dad, who treasured accuracy in communications as he did, would then say what he did to the waiter. So, coffee, espresso, Sambuca, check. One day I was out ill, and I received a call from one of my subordinates who was complaining about a criticism he had just received from your dad. Apparently, as he was accustomed to do, your dad called this trader and requested a piece of information. The trader said that he would be back in 5 minutes. When the trader reverted in 10 minutes, your dad read him the Riot Act for being 5 minutes late. When the trader called me to complain, I simply advised him that he should not have promised 5 minutes if he could not deliver on the promise. On a more serious note, I have known your dad for 33 years. He is a good and dear friend. There is usually agreement that serendipity, or chance, has a great deal to do with success in life. In fact, a recent book entitled Fooled by Randomness establishes that chance influences almost every successful situation. In late 1973, I was a junior clerk in the operations area for the Eurodollar desk. Apparently, although I had not yet met your dad, he had heard of me and was impressed with my performance in the operations area. He was, at that time, looking for new traders to work on the growing Euro-dollar desk at 399 Park Avenue. Following a Christmas season lunch, which your dad hosted, and at which he introduced himself to me, he and I walked back into 399, and as we headed up the escalator, he said to me, "We're going to take good care of you." For a young, aspiring, and relatively inexperienced man to hear such a commitment from a senior executive like your dad, it was a defining moment. The rest is history for me, but your dad's early involvement in my career unquestionably placed me on a track that I, without a doubt, would never have been. While I have worked with many good, decent, and highly professional people during my career, your dad taught me how to think business, and the importance of assuring an understanding of the questions and issues, no matter how many times one must ask before accomplishing that goal. My wife Linda and I do not see enough of your dad and Jill, but thank heavens we usually see them a couple times each year, and it is always a great time out, talking about old stories and about what we are all doing in retirement. I wish nothing but the best for your dad, who was an important person in my life. Serendipity is defined as an apparent aptitude for making fortunate discoveries accidentally.
It worked. Rich understood that this was a great opportunity for him to learn interest rate trading in addition to FX rates, which he already could do very well. At the time, I said that he was growing his second leg, the interest rate leg, in addition to his already existing FX leg. Rich Mahoney left Citibank a few years later, and became a very senior person in Bank of New York, in charge of all treasury business of that bank. He knows that having grown his second leg was pivotal for him getting that big job at Bank of New York. By the way, his baby was born a healthy boy in 1981, and, as of this writing, that baby is 36 years old. The period between 1981 and 1982 was also the time when financial derivatives were developed. Under my supervision, my traders and Citibank played a key role in that development. At the end of 1981, we did the first foreign exchange option for $5 million against Swiss francs with Nestle in Switzerland. Something similar was true for interest rate derivatives, like interest rate conversion agreements, commonly and substandardly called interest rate swaps, as well as forward interest rate agreements. These new derivative FX and interest rate products needed to be explained first to our own marketing people and ultimately to our customers. Also, I approved for Lisa Polsky to develop and invest in a product called CityTrend. This was an FX trading system based on technical analysis that decided when to buy and sell foreign currencies. We first used it for our own account, and after it proved to be successful, we sold it to customers so they could use it for a fee. In early 1981, there was one more important milestone in my life. I was promoted to become a corporate senior vice president of Citibank. This made me one of the top 100 officers of this largest bank in the world. Member of New York Federal Reserve Bank's Foreign Exchange Committee, 1981. Ernst Brucher had represented Citibank on the New York Federal Reserve Bank's Fed Foreign Exchange Committee, FXC, since its inception in 1978. When Ernst left Citibank, the Fed called the Public Relations Department of Citibank to request that Citibank nominate another representative on that committee. The head of Citibank's Public Relations Department was Rick Wheeler, my tennis friend from the 1970s. He recommended me, which, of course, was also supported by the fact that I was now the head of all foreign exchange trading in North America. This Foreign Exchange Committee is an industry group that has been providing guidance and leadership to the global foreign exchange market since its founding in 1978. It is sponsored by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and includes representatives of major financial institutions engaged in foreign currency trading in the United States. Aware of the strong integration of the global foreign exchange market, the FXC is also an active partner with other foreign exchange committees and industry associations worldwide. The FXC's objectives include serving as a forum for the discussion of good practices and technical issues in the FX market, fostering improvements in risk management in the FX market by offering recommendations and guidelines and supporting actions that facilitate greater contractual certainties for all parties active in foreign exchange. Membership of the Foreign Exchange Committee is only by invitation of the Fed. It is an honor to be selected and a very big deal. Later, I will talk about my activities as an expert witness in disputes about financial trading and investing as described later in this book. I found that in my affidavits and testimonies in court, the fact that I had been a member of this committee for 15 years, 1981 to 1995, and chairman for 3 years from 1986 to 1988, always made a big impression on judges and juries and carried a lot of weight, adding to my credibility in court. The committee meets over lunch on the first Thursday of every month in the building of the New York Fed. In January, this meeting is held over dinner. The past chairman get invited to this dinner, and I enjoy to this day the opportunity once a year to meet in person the movers and shakers of the American FX market. When I first joined the committee in 1981, I noticed that the members, about 15, were very serious at lunch. There was never laughter or banter. Everybody looked around and was careful before saying something, in fear that they could say something wrong. I quickly developed a good relationship with Gretchen Green, who at the time was the FX head at the Fed and secretary of the committee. Later her bosses were Peter R. Fisher and Dino Koss. The latter had been my student in my MBA class at New York University, NYU. After I had been a member of the committee for a couple of years, I organized a tennis outing in my Midtown Tennis Club at Sutton Place in Manhattan, only a couple of blocks away from where Jill and I lived at the time. We met at my club for lunch for our regular monthly meeting. In the afternoon, we played tennis, followed by dinner at the club with lots of good food, wine, and laughter. The dinner was also attended by Jerry Corrigan, at the time president of the New York Fed, which gave the entire affair a nice senior flavor. After the committee members had seen each other in tennis shorts, our monthly meetings were much more relaxed. Those who did not play tennis were asked to show up in tennis attire anyway. Just as I had been the change agent and innovator at Citibank for everything that had to do with financial trading, I also brought all these new ideas to the FXC. The committee produces an annual report that contains all important memoranda the committee published during the past year. Many of these memoranda were authored by me and found their way into these annual reports. I was very proud when I wrote and signed the overview in these 3 years when I was chairman. In my first 10 years as a member of the committee, from 1981 to 1990, the committee focused on the best practices of actual trading in the foreign exchange and money markets. Later, there was also focus on internal controls and risk management. As I was instrumental at Citibank in developing many of these new control systems, I brought some also to the attention of this committee. And in 1991, until I retired at the end of 1995, I became chairman of the FX Committee's Risk Management Subcommittee. Needless to say, I developed close relationships with the committee members who were all top FX people of the major local and foreign banks in the USA. One such person was Stefan Bubb, who was the senior trader of the German Hypel Vereinsbank in New York. I will have more to say about him later. My largest transaction, buying gold for the Japanese Emperor. Hirohito, 1901 to 1989, was Emperor of Japan from 1926 until his death in 1989. In order to celebrate and commemorate his 60th year as emperor in 1986, the Japanese government decided to create a gold coin in his honor. Specifically, they wanted to strike 6 million coins of 1 ounce each. At the end of 1985, the price of gold was about $320 per ounce, so that 6 million ounces equated to almost $2 billion. Purchasing such a large amount would move the price of gold higher. The challenge was to buy it as cheaply as possible. At that time, one of my responsibilities in Citibank was gold trading, including supervising and managing the Citibank Gold Vault in Basement C at 399 Park Avenue, which is the largest private gold storage facility in the USA. Only the United States Bullion Depository, often known as Fort Knox, is larger. We did not speculate in gold, but used it in the context of corporate finance. We also provided long-term hedges for gold mining companies. They knew that they had gold in the ground, and they knew the cost of mining it. They did not know at what price they would be able to sell the gold 2 to 5 years into the future. That is where my department came in. Using the same basic treasury concept with which I had created forward exchange markets around the world in the mid-1970s, I was able to calculate and provide long-term forward prices for gold. We bought the gold forward from the mining companies, sold spot gold in the market, and borrowed the gold in the market, ending up with 2 to 5 year dollars at a fixed interest rate, usually well below the prevailing market rate. Our senior Japanese officer, Umisomo-san, had convinced his friends in the Japanese government that we would not front-run their order. Front-running means that we would first buy gold for our own account, driving up the price, then start buying for the Japanese, and in the end, selling to the Japanese our pre-purchased gold at a large profit. Because of the size of the order and the near certainty that the price would rise if this information were to leak out, the entire deal had to be kept top secret. In addition to my two gold traders and me, only about 10 other people in Citibank knew about this gold trade. The transaction was without risk for Citibank. We'd agreed on the scale of average prices and profit for us. The higher the average purchase price, the lower was our profit. Conversely, the lower the average purchase price, the larger the profit for us. The only risk was a lower profit, but there was no chance for a loss. One important part of the agreement was that the gold to be delivered and sold to the Japanese had to be what is known in the trade as 4-9 gold. This means that 99.99% of the gold had to be actual gold. So normal gold traded in the market at the time, at $320 per ounce, is called 2-9 gold, which means that only 99% of the gold is actual gold. The other 1% is usually copper, to make the gold a little harder and less likely to scratch. Gold for jewelry is usually 18 carats, or 75% gold. We started buying in the fourth quarter of 1985. The process of buying was slow. We had to be careful not to be too aggressive with our purchases to avoid driving the market price up too much. At the end of each day, we reported to Japan the amount of gold we bought and the average price. We planned to do this until all the gold was bought. Then, we would be able to calculate the grand average price and, based on that, determine our profit as described above. In those days, the Russians were a big factor in the gold market. They traded in the market for two reasons. One, when they needed dollars to beef up their foreign exchange reserves, they would sell their own gold, which they produced in large quantities. All Russian gold was produced as 4-9 gold. So when the Russians sold 4-9 gold, the world knew they were selling their own gold, and the world lowered the gold price a little to disadvantage the Russians. Two, the Russians also were professional in and out traders in the world gold market. That is, they bought when they thought it was cheap, and they sold when they thought that the price was too high. In other words, they were just ordinary traders like everybody else in the market, including Citibank. When they participated in the market in that capacity, they were selling 2-9 gold just like everybody else. In such cases, the world did not manipulate the gold price a little lower, because they knew that the Russians were just trading and not liquidating part of their gold reserves to raise much-needed dollars.
Just before Christmas 1985, I went to Moscow with my two gold traders. My idea was to cozy up with the Russians over a bottle of vodka and possibly buy the entire $2 billion worth of gold from them in one single trade. It would have been a super win-slash-win situation for both of us. They had the gold and needed the dollars. I had the dollars and needed the gold. Do the trade in one shot, completely bypassing the market, not moving the price even a tiny bit, and securing a maximum profit for Citibank. If we could have made it happen, we would have bought all the needed gold without moving the market price at all. It would have been great, but I could not bring myself to trust them. If I had told them the truth,
there was a chance that they would have started buying gold and driving up the price. In addition, my purchases in the open market would have further increased the gold price. At that time, they could have sold their own gold to raise the needed dollars at a fantastically high price. This was too much of a risk, and I never proposed my plan. We bought just $10 million worth of gold from them, and that was it. We managed to buy the needed gold in the open market and did not increase the price too much, so that we made a nice profit of about $60 million. The price of gold moved up a little less than 10%, from $320 to $350 per ounce. However, before celebrating the successful deal, there was one larger problem to overcome. The gold we had bought in the market was 2 9 gold, and we had promised the Japanese to deliver 4 9 gold. The traditionally normal way to convert 2 9 gold into 4 9 gold is to melt it down and refine it into the wanted 4 9 gold. The problem was that our amount of gold was too big for that process to work within the limited time we had available. If all the gold refineries in the world had stopped doing what they were doing and only worked for me refining my gold, there still would not have been enough time for them to finish in time to meet the committed deadline for the gold to arrive in Japan. We had a big problem. At that point, I had one of my more creative moments. I went back to the Russians and proposed the following. Let's do one gigantic $2 billion gold trade. I will give you what I have, that is 2 9 gold, and you will give me what you have, that is 4 9 gold. The advantage for me was that my problem was solved. I converted 2 9 gold into 4 9 gold. The advantage for the Russians was that they could go to the world market and sell $2 billion worth of 2 9 gold when they needed dollars. The world would not lower the price, because the world saw them selling 2 9 gold and would think that they were just trading and not liquidating their gold reserves. Of course, I was getting 0.99%, or almost 1% more gold from them, and had to pay the Russians that value differential of almost $20 million, difference between 99% and 99.99% gold. Another problem was that the 4 9 gold we bought from the Russians under this 99% for 99.99% exchange had to be assayed to assure that this was indeed 4 9 gold and not a lesser purity. It turned out that the Russian gold producers were not very accurate. Some gold bars were much less pure, and others were purer than 99.99%. This led to arguments with the Russians, and we finally settled on a Swiss assayer to determine the purity. No bar is ever exactly 99.99%. They are all a little more or a little less. The differences are tallied, and in the end, one cash adjustment is made for the grand net of all the impurities. The deal was done, and everybody was happy. When we celebrated with the Russians in Moscow, they put a bottle of vodka on the tables that was room temperature. I inquired about the temperature and said that we in the West believe that vodka should be chilled. They agreed, but regretted serving it warm, because we do not have a refrigerator. Think about that. True story. I was still not out of the woods. The gold had to be flown to Osaka, Japan, and there was not that much time left. The issue was that there was a value limit for insurance purposes as to how much gold could be put on one single plane. We ran frantically around and bought cargo space wherever we could, and finally, we made it. Hallelujah.
Other funny story surrounding this deal. One would think that a coin commemorating a famous person like the Japanese emperor would have the person's face on one side of the coin. Not so in this case. The coin might be in a pocket together with a key or another metal item and produce a scratch on the emperor's face. That must never happen. Therefore, the coin had flowers on both sides. We were told by experts on Russia back in the US that we should expect to be monitored and listened to anywhere we may be. The only way to be sure that our environment was not bugged was to take a walk outside. Good advice, but remember it was December when we were in Moscow, and the temperatures were below the freezing point. There were Christmas trees all over the city. The tour guide told us that they were officially called year-end trees. The Russians left no trick untried to get any possible secrets out of us. They had girls calling us in our rooms at night, offering to be our friend for the night. They even had German girls calling me. They had been recruited from what was at the time communist East Germany. Remember, this was 1985, and the Berlin Wall did not come down until 1989. Miscellaneous teaching activities, beginning at New York University. When I was back in New York in 1981 and got my feet on the ground in terms of starting my new responsibilities at Citibank, I also felt the desire to teach an MBA program again at a university, just as I did in Manila at the Asian Institute of Management. The Bible says in Romans 12, 6-7, if God gave you the gift to teach, you should teach. I discussed my idea with my friend and co-author, Rita Rodriguez, and she recommended that I call Professor Ingo Volter at New York University, NYU. Ingo had overseen her doctoral thesis, and she spoke very highly of him. When I talked to Ingo on the phone, he asked me what I wanted to teach. I described my ideas about foreign exchange and money markets, and how this worked together to produce a course on international treasury management. He said, "Write it up. I will put it on the board, and if at least 15 students sign up, you have a course. We will start in the fall of 1982 as a mini course of 7 sessions, 75 minutes each, and it will be worth 1.5 credits for the students." I wrote it up. He posted it on the board. More than 15 students signed up, and adjunct professor of finance and international business at NYU, Heinz Riehl, was born. I gave my course only a couple of times as a mini course, and then it was upgraded to a full 3-credit course. Needless to say, I encouraged my students to buy my book, Foreign Exchange Markets, because it would help them to understand the material. They could also use it later as a reference. Towards the end of each course, I invited my students to come to Citibank at 399 Park Avenue, where I would show them the dealing room for which I had responsibility. This was very impressive and educational for them. They were looking at almost a football field size room full of people staring at computer screens. The traders had multiple phone lines available. Often they were screaming in foreign languages and mentioning large amounts of foreign currencies. I would point out to students the treasury concept in practical action. They could see the different sections handling and interfacing in Spot FX, Forward FX, Corporate FX, Offshore Nassau Euro Dollar Trading,
euro-dollar futures trading. This was a much more practical teaching style than the typical professor would apply. Also, when a student asked a question in class, I would typically answer, "Well, the other day a customer had this or that problem, and we solved the problem in this or that manner." In other words, my teaching was very practical and far away from any excessively academic or theoretical approach. I was teaching what I had invented myself, and traders were applying it under my supervision. Most other professors were teaching something that they had learned from reading a book. All of this made my classes very popular, and they were usually oversubscribed. That is, there were more students wanting to register for my class than there was room in the classroom. Later, in 1982, I was approached by the Institute of Banking and Finance, IBF, in Singapore, with a request to teach in their treasury program. It turned out that the commercial attaché of the Singapore Embassy in Washington had called New York University, NYU, and asked for a recommendation as to who could teach the treasury program at the newly created IBF Singapore. NYU gave him my name, and the rest is history. I accepted an offer to teach twice a year for 4 days and continued to teach at the IBF in Singapore as a co-founder of the program for over 20 years. When I look into the mirror and reflect on how my professional profile must have looked from the IBF viewpoint, it must have been quite impressive. Senior Vice President of Citibank, in charge of their trading in North America. Author of a book on foreign exchange, published by McGraw-Hill. Past regional treasurer for Asia-Pacific and familiar with the Asian financial markets. Member of the New York Federal Reserve Bank's Foreign Exchange Committee. Professor of Finance at New York University. I almost cannot believe that this awesome description is me. The IBF was an arm of the Singapore Central Bank, the Monetary Authority Singapore, MAS. The head of the IBF reported directly into the MAS. The objective of the IBF was to maintain the financial expertise of finance officers in Singapore at a high, world-class level. This applied to both bankers and the finance officers of non-financial institutions. My courses at the IBF were well received and attended not only by Singaporeans, but also by participants from other Asian countries. Additionally, the central banks of other Asian countries copied the Singapore idea and set up their own banking schools. This applied to Jakarta, Indonesia, Hong Kong, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. The heads of all those schools heard about what I was doing in Singapore and invited me to teach in their respective programs. The majority of participants in those programs were, of course, bankers. It happened quite often that those bankers liked what they heard and invited me to give in-house programs at their respective banks. In those cases, I always got specific approval from the respective Citibank country head to give an in-house program at a given bank. Some people in Citibank were concerned that I might give away secrets, but the majority felt that there really were no secrets for any meaningful time. Whenever Citibank came out with a new product, it was soon copied by other banks anyway. We were also arrogant and felt that even if they understood what Citibank was doing, they would not have the people to execute and copy a given strategy, or copy the production and sale of a given product. Ingo Volter from NYU turned into a really good friend. he advised me what the going rates and teaching fees were, so that I knew what I could charge for seminars, both at academic institutions as well as at banks for in-house programs. The Business School of NYU became the Leonard N. Stern School of Business. Mr. Stern came as a child with his father from Germany in the early 1940s to New York and worked in his father's business selling caged birds, bird cages, and other pet bird supplies. He graduated from the NYU Business School and took over the business from his father, turning it into a multinational corporation. In 1988, he donated $30 million to NYU, and NYU built a new building for the school. I attended the groundbreaking ceremony when Mr. Stern explained the reason for his big gift. I made it in life because I was smart. Today, life is so complex that just being smart is not good enough anymore. In addition to being smart, you need the best possible schools. I want to help build the NYU Business School into such a school. I also taught for many years in the Executive MBA program of NYU. The dean of which was Norman Berman. This was both fun and educational for me. The students were mid-career people who were very knowledgeable in whatever they were doing in their jobs. Here is the birthday letter from Norman Berman, former dean of executive education at New York University.
Hines has been a great success in all he did. I know him in a narrower perspective as the Dean of Executive Education at the Stern School of Business, New York University, when he was teaching in the program. At Stern, he was a wonderful teacher, having been nominated for the Excellence in Teaching Award by his students several times and the winner at least once. Hines was a master of his subject matter, but I would also assign him in particular situations where ability to bring a class to a high level and good spirit was important. He bonded with his class and they sought him out after class for convivial conversation. I remember one anecdote that describes him. One day I was standing next to him outside the classroom for his 8:30 a.m. class. It was about 8:35 and some students were not there. "Oh," Hines exclaimed, "where are these people? Don't they know I have a German passport?" Norman D. Berman.
I taught the entire program in 1 week at the Doral Arrowwood Hotel in White Plains, New York. My program included my bourse game, which was quite popular with students. I remember Janet Vitebsky, one of Norman Berman's assistants, who was always of great help. Here is a birthday letter from Janet Vitebsky, New York University, Executive MBA Program.
I am traveling in Patagonia right now. My mind is blank after several extremely relaxing days, and I am working on a pretty slow computer, but here is my favorite experience with Hines. I met Hines a few months after starting to work at Stern Executive Programs. I was still nervous and still learning the job. Hines was very supportive and would never let me say anything negative about myself or even hint at the idea that there is something that I can't do. I once mentioned that his subject matter, international treasury management, was a little bit above my understanding, and he waved his hand and acted as if I just said the silliest thing in the world. He then went on to give me a clear explanation of something he teaches and how easy it would be for me if I wanted to learn it. He also told me the most inspiring story that has stuck with me for these years. It was about a student who came late to class for an exam. The exam was distributed and there was an additional question on the board. He completed the exam but couldn't quite get the answer to the question on the board. He kept working on it and working on it and eventually brought the solution to his professor. He told the professor that he had a really hard time with this but was persistent until he figured it out. The professor was in shock. He had put that question on the board at the beginning of class as an example of a problem that cannot be solved. It has never been solved, and the general consensus by the scholars involved was that it was not solvable. The student missed this introduction because he was late, and not knowing it was an unsolvable problem, he went ahead and solved it. I think that this story is so powerful and inspiring that really anything can be done if you believe it can be. I'm so grateful to Heinz for telling me that story and for his friendship and support the past few years. Janet Vitebsky.
The hotel has a 9-hole golf course, and I inaugurated a NYU golf tournament to be held during a free afternoon. To make it more interesting, I donated the Professor Heinz Riehl Cup, with the winners' names engraved on the trophy. This annual tournament was held more than 10 times until I stopped teaching in the program. One year, I was busy correcting papers from another program and could not participate in the golf tournament. There was a moment when I lifted my head to reflect on a thought. As I looked out of the window of my hotel room, I saw one of my students right below my window, looking at his golf ball under a bush. The guy looked around to make sure that nobody was watching, and then kicked the ball with his foot from the bush into a more open area. The question, what does one do in a situation like this? I decided to keep it between the two of us. I gave him a character education based on golf's first tee organization and its 9 core values: honesty, integrity, sportsmanship, respect, confidence, responsibility, perseverance, courtesy, and judgment, and suggested that he live his personal and professional life according to these principles. Teaching in the NYU Stern Executive MBA program stimulated my competitive drive. At the end of each year, students voted for their favorite professor. The professor who received the most votes was given the Excellence in Teaching Award from the school. This award was announced at the annual graduation party, which was always a prominent and elegant affair. I have to be honest and admit that whenever the award was announced and given to a professor, it bothered me that once again I had not received it. Competition was serious. It included the school's top professors who spent the entire year with those students and could schmooze around with them during coffee breaks and other times when they were not actually teaching them. In contrast, I just taught my course on Treasury Risk Management, and that was it. In spite of all this, 1999 was my year. Executive Education Dean Norman Berman called me ahead of the graduation ceremony, assuring that I would attend in person to receive the award. It was a wonderful feeling, and I was happy because such an award can only be earned from the students. One such enthusiastic student was Claudia Volpi. Here is the birthday letter from Claudia Santurio Volpi. Former student, New York University, class of 2000. Heinz was my professor in the Executive MBA program at NYU Stern. I cannot believe he's 70. I would go even further to say that he was my favorite professor ever. I had had quite a few in my many years of study, but he was fun, enthusiastic, dedicated, and oh so charming. We stayed in touch as I later met up with him again while in sales and trading training at Chase Manhattan Bank, and even corresponded once I left banking to become a wife and mother. I'm happy to be included in this memory book, and I am sure that he will absolutely love it. Best regards. Heinz thanks for challenging me and making it fun, and for always helping us to see the bright side of things with your infinite optimism and charm. Happy birthday. I wish you many more years of happiness and good times. Claudia Santurio Volpi, Finance 2000, Stern. meeting Jill, the love of my life, in February of 1983. Jill Novak was a student in my MBA class at New York University, NYU. She had moved to New York from Boston a few years prior and was now working for New York's Chemical Bank in the area of treasury risk management and internal controls. She was going for her MBA in evening classes, and of course, all my classes were in the evening because of my responsibilities at Citibank. She knew my friend Tom Johnston, who had become president of her bank. Jill and I immediately took a liking to each other. I had to be very careful not to be seen dating a student while that student was still in my class. NYU monitored those situations very carefully. There had been romantic relationships between students and professors in exchange for better grades, and those professors were disciplined very severely. Like all other students, Jill had purchased my book at the beginning of the course and paid with her personal check. This had given me her private address and phone number, but I could not do much with that to advance our relationship. After I had taught a couple of evenings in Jill's class, the following situation developed. It was Tuesday morning, and I was sitting in my Citibank office trying to prepare for my evening lecture in Jill's class at NYU. At that time, I was also teaching other courses to other audiences, both inside and outside Citibank. I noticed that I was a little confused and had forgotten how far I had advanced with my materials the previous week in Jill's NYU class. I had to know this so that I could continue that evening where I had stopped the previous week. Suddenly, I got what I thought was a brilliant idea, to phone Jill and ask her how far I had advanced with my material in the previous class. She'd attended that class and had to know easily the answer to my question. It also was a good excuse to hear her lovely voice on the phone. Jill told me later that when I called and asked my question, she had no idea about what I had covered in the previous class. Of course, she could not admit that. Instead, she said, "Professor, I'm sorry, but I cannot help you because I already read ahead in your book. I am already beyond the point where you may have stopped last week." It was a brilliant response on her part, even though it was not helpful for me at the time. It was an early demonstration of how smart Jill is. At that time, my course was focused on explaining financial trading. Only the last class covered risk management and internal controls. Up to the penultimate class, I had only casual conversations with Jill. However, at the end of that class, I told her, "I know that you will be particularly interested in the subject we will cover next week, because that is close to what you are doing at Chemical Bank. In class, we will have only 75 minutes for discussion. However, if you like, I can make myself available for a cup of tea after class in order to answer any more questions you might have." Jill agreed to meet after that last class. In the morning of that last class day, I had again invited my students, including Jill, to come to Citibank at 399 Park Avenue so that I could show them my dealing room and how the treasury concept worked in practice. The tour of my dealing room began in my spacious corner office, 6th floor, corner of Park Avenue and 53rd Street. I had on the credenza next to my desk a large screen computer on, which I could follow the risk positions taken by the various departments I was supervising. As I rolled back my swivel chair so that students had better access to my computer screen, Jill positioned herself right on the middle of my desk. As a result, she had a perfect view of my computer, and I had a perfect view of her. In my mind, I still see her sitting there, smart, charming, beautiful, and irresistible. I already began to look forward to the evening. The photo below shows the credenza and computer to my right, and in front of me, my desk, on which Jill positioned herself.
As we got into the car after class that evening, I decided instead of tea to take her to a nice Italian restaurant named Divino on 2nd Avenue and 81st Street. We had a long conversation, good food, and a lot of wine. At the end of the dinner, I told her, "Jill, I think that we have a lot to give to each other."
We both remember this statement, and to this day it has been so very true. That dinner was in March 1983, and we celebrate the date ever since as one of our important anniversaries. We did not want our relationship to be known by our two respective banks because of our responsibilities and seniority. Therefore, Jill's best friend, Mary Davis, at Chemical Bank, frequently served as the go-between to provide cover for us. Here is the birthday letter from Mary Davis, London, Jill's best friend at Chemical Bank.
Dear Heinz, I knew my best friend was in trouble when I heard your deep, sexy German accent on the phone. You were charming and witty and made me feel as if you wanted to take me out. But it was not to be. You were only interested in my beautiful, intelligent, fun and loyal friend, Jill. Being the point of contact for each of you was exciting and nerve-wracking. I had to get all the arrangements right. At the time, you were a high-powered banker working for a rival bank where Jill and I worked and met, and your name would be recognised if you left a message with just anyone. That's where I came in. My friendship with Jill was cemented after a farewell drinks party at a well-known Irish bar in downtown Manhattan. That story will only be told when Jill reaches 70. Now back to you, Heinz. Shall I be old-fashioned and say you swept her off her feet? Yes, I shall. She would never admit to you, or herself, this was the situation, but I knew. Heinz, you invited me to join you and Jill for dinner one night to thank me for my help. It was wonderful to see you both so happy and in love. Even being the third wheel, you made me feel welcome, important, and appreciated. To this day, to my astonishment, you even remember what colour I wore that night. Our friendship grew during your relationship with Jill, and you both even spent Christmas Day with my family and me at our home in New York, before I headed off on my first foreign service assignment in Amman, Jordan. Sadly, I missed your wedding day, but my heart was with you. I have many more wonderful memories of you, but this is the one that rises to the top. We don't see each other often, as I live in London most of the year with my terrific husband, Peter, and our two daughters. When we were in Florida, you were in North Carolina. When you were in Florida, we were in London. When we met in London last year, it felt as if it had only been weeks, not years, since we spent time together. I know this will always be the case. Please continue to appreciate, love, and take care of my best friend Jill, as you have done for all these years. Heinz, I wish you the best birthday ever, with lots of love and happiness, to last till you're at least 100. Much love, Mary.
Important weekend in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. In 1944, the Bretton Woods Monetary Conference was held at the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. At that time, representatives of 44 countries established the World Bank, set the dollar/gold parity at $35 an ounce, and chose the American dollar as the backbone of international foreign exchange. The meeting provided the world with badly needed post-war currency stability. It had become tradition to commemorate this important meeting every year with a meeting of leaders in the foreign exchange and financial markets in New England. I had been invited to be the keynote speaker at that conference, held on Friday, October 7th, 1983, at the Mount Washington Hotel. It was the peak of the foliage season, and I invited Jill to join me for that weekend. I delivered my speech on Friday, stayed that evening with Jill at the hotel, and on Saturday drove to Killington, Vermont, where we had reservations at the Red Clover Inn. In the middle of a romantic dinner that Saturday evening, Jill and I stumbled into a serious discussion about the future of our relationship. In particular, Jill wanted me to be more fully committed to her, just as she was to me. After all, I was not yet legally divorced. At the end of the dinner, we pretty much broke up, or at least were no longer committed to each other on an exclusive basis. Fortunately, we were in the middle of nowhere in Vermont. We could not just go home. Instead, we went to our room and had breakfast together the following morning, Sunday, October 9th. It was a gorgeous, perfect fall day in Vermont, and we decided to take a walk in the nearby woods. I loved Jill, did not want to lose her, and pondered the conversation of the previous night in my mind. Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Suddenly, I remembered Abraham Maslow's philosophy about the hierarchy of needs that I had learned about while at Harvard some 9 years earlier. It became clear to me that Jill and I were on a path to self-actualization if we would give to each other the third stage in that five-step hierarchy, which is love and belonging. Below are those five steps in the order of importance, which I tried to explain to Jill while we were walking in the woods. Biological and physiological needs: air, food, drink, shelter, warmth, sex, and sleep. Safety needs: protection from the elements, security, order, law, stability, and freedom from fear. Love and belonging needs: friendship, intimacy, affection and love obtained from work group, family, friends, and romantic relationships. Esteem needs: achievement, mastery, independence, status, dominance, prestige, self-respect, and respect from others. Self-actualization needs: realizing personal potential, self-fulfillment, seeking personal growth, and peak experiences. Important in general, and particularly in that situation for Jill and me, is that these needs must be met and fulfilled in sequence. For example, I can be in an extremely safe place fulfilling the second need, but if I do not have food and water, which is the first need, I will die. Likewise, I may have fulfilled the fourth need, and I am famous and have the esteem of others, for example, like Marilyn Monroe had. However, if I have not fulfilled the third need for love and belonging, I will not be happy. I will not be able to continue my path towards self-actualization, the fifth need. While walking in the woods that day, I shared with Jill my feelings that we were in that situation. We both had achieved many things and were admired by people in our professional careers, but we were not happy. However, if we could love each other and fulfill for each other the third need, we would be happy and be able to continue our life path towards self-actualization. According to Maslow, only about 1% of people reach this final stage. Jill understood and agreed. We reconciled right then and there. We applied the observation made on our first date in March earlier that year, that we have a lot to give to each other. Because of the importance of the Maslow philosophy for Jill and me, I commissioned a painting in 1985. In this painting, Joseph Shepherd shows the five needs from left to right. I believe that for many people, the first two needs, food and safety, are relatively easy to meet. If one works hard, one can also be successful and be admired by others, which is the fourth need. However, that third need of love and belonging is not so easy to fulfill. Therefore, I asked the artist to visually elevate the image of that need. In other words, I want to show that on our path from left to right, we have to climb uphill to reach and fulfill that third need of love and belonging. The couple, symbolizing the fifth need of self-actualization, has experienced the ongoing process of fully developing their personal potential. They are shown naked to indicate that material wealth does not contribute to that stage of fulfillment and happiness. Instead, they know that given the natural gifts they were born with, they have made the most of themselves. A good analogy might be a diamond with some flaws. There is nothing that diamond can do about those flaws. However, it can be cut, polished, and set in a masterful way, so that it appears as beautiful as possible. Jill's first trip to Asia. A few weeks later, in November 1983, I had a teaching engagement in Hong Kong, but it was cancelled on short notice. I decided to go anyway, and invited Jill to come with me for her first trip to the Far East. I had business to do in California and met Jill on a Friday evening at the airport in Los Angeles. From there, we flew together to Honolulu in Hawaii, where we had a multi-hour stopover before going on to Jakarta, Indonesia. We arrived at the Jakarta Hilton around Sunday late afternoon and were both very tired. This was almost 2 days after leaving Los Angeles, which is a long time even when one allows for the 15-hour time difference. When Jill saw the bed, she dove into it and fell asleep. We later called that the Jakarta dive. We slept some 10 hours, and at 3 o'clock the following morning ordered a big meal from room service. A couple of days later, we flew to Yogyakarta, a city on the Indonesian island of Java. From there, we hired a private chauffeur-driven limo to take us to the famous Buddhist temple, Borobudur. The Borobudur is a 9th century Mahayana Buddhist temple in Magelang, central Java, Indonesia. The monument consists of 9 stacked platforms, 6 square and 3 circular, topped by a central dome. It is considered one of the 7 world wonders. During that 2-hour ride, we saw animals we had never seen before. Jill saw brown and black chickens for the first time in her life. She thought that all chickens were white. Before boarding our plane back to Jakarta, we had a meal in Yogyakarta, where Jill ate with her hands for the first time. The entire trip was quite an exotic experience. After a few more days in Jakarta, including enjoying the rice tafel at the famous Oasis restaurant, we went on to Hong Kong and stayed at the brand new Regent Hotel on the Kowloon side. Jill liked the view across Victoria Harbour and the sparkling Hong Kong skyline. We ascended to the peak on Hong Kong's historic funicular railway. The peak circle walk loops around the highest point on Hong Kong Island, ensuring the best views from every angle. Jill and I took this walk, and it was fabulous. At some point, we sat down on a bench, and I rested my head in Jill's lap. It was a most memorable moment. Across the street from the Regent Hotel is the famous Peninsula Hotel. I had made reservations at its Swiss Cheza restaurant. We intentionally arrived early to have a drink in the lobby, which also is a world-renowned place. While we were waiting and having a drink, Jill and I both had a very special, never-before-experienced feeling. For me, it felt as if the Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit was coming over me, saying, "This is the girl for you. Stay with her for the rest of your life. I send you this beshert." Jill had similar feelings, even though she did not think that it was the Holy Spirit. One evening, while Jill and I were dating in 1983, and Jill worked at Chemical Bank, she told me the following story. Jill and two of her colleagues took a class to learn the details of new products called derivatives. The instructor briefly explained each instrument, and he described how the derivative would work. When he got to foreign exchange, the instructor gave a brief description of FX, and then said if the students wanted to learn more, they should read the book written by the grandfather of foreign exchange, Heinz Riehl. Jill's colleagues were aware of her relationship with me, and since they were all in their late 20s, thought this description of her boyfriend was hilarious. On January 8, 1984, Jill agreed to move in with me at my 79th Street apartment. The actual move occurred at the beginning of February, on a day when I was on a business trip to Mexico. Jill's father, Marvin, and wife, Betty, came from Boston with his truck and helped her to move. My dreams are in general nothing out of the ordinary, just dreams like most people have them. During the 1970s and early 1980s, there is one type of dream I had frequently, and I consider it worth mentioning here. In those dreams, I found myself wanting to run away from something, or wanting to run toward something. However, I could not really run. I could not move forward at all, because my feet or my shoes felt very heavy like lead. My feet felt like being stuck in something, and I could not pull them out. I remember that my hands were up and reaching for something ahead of me, but I could never reach it. It was very frustrating, and at the peak of my frustration, I would usually wake up. Once I began to live with Jill in 1984, those dreams subsided, and fortunately never came back. On that day, another important thing happened. I had not yet told my daughter Janine about Jill, so while Jill and her father Marvin were sitting in my 79th Street apartment, the phone rang. Jill answered the phone, and Janine was at the other end. It was an embarrassing situation for both, and I still feel guilty for not having told Janine about Jill earlier. Even though this was an unfortunate start, Jill and Janine have developed a unique and wonderful relationship ever since that time. Jill's family is Jewish, and the time came when the entire family had to learn about me. Here is Jill, the first member of the entire greater Jewish family since they moved from the Polish/Russian border to America to have gone to college. Less than 30 years old, she had become successful in so many ways, living in New York and having a great job with prestigious chemical bank, and now seemingly throwing her life away with whom? A German, 20 years older than Jill, divorced two times, with a total of three children. What could be worse for a Jewish family? I met Jill's mother, Phyllis, and got along well with her. Father Marvin also was no problem. At that time, Marvin and Phyllis had been divorced for some 10 years. The last hurdle to be taken was to meet Jill's grandparents. What were these grandparents like? As a young man, Grandpa Phil had lied about his age in order to get into the U.S. Navy to fight and kill as many German Nazis as possible. To his regret, he never got to fight German Nazis. Instead, he was assigned to the Pacific and spent several months at the U.S. Naval Base in Subic Bay near Manila in the Philippines. Grandma Sidel had worked for several years in a factory making ammunition and bullets for American soldiers, also to kill Nazis. In the summer of 1984, I had to meet those grandparents of Jill. The meeting took place on a Sunday afternoon for coffee in Mother Phyllis's apartment in Boston. Within minutes, my conversation with Grandpa moved to the facts that we both had spent time in the Philippines. We were even able to refer to a few interesting locations in Manila that we both had gotten to know well. It was clear, Grandpa had no problem with me. My overall demeanor and impression made that afternoon must also have been acceptable to Grandma. Jill told me later that after a few minutes, Grandma took her aside in the kitchen and said, never minds that he is German, divorced, and has kids. The most important thing is that he loves you, and that is what counts. You have my blessings.
While the 79th Street apartment was cute and romantic, it was also quite small. We decided to look for another, more suitable place to live. Jill found a wonderful two-bedroom apartment with a wood-burning fireplace on Sutton Place at 455 East 57th Street. A real gem of an apartment. It was close to my office at Citibank and near a bus stop for Jill to go directly to Wall Street. Sutton Place is one of the best residential areas in Manhattan. I had to go through an interview with the board. One of the board members tried to explain to me the exclusivity of the building by saying, "Mr. Real, from your viewpoint, you are buying an apartment in this building. From our viewpoint, we are taking you into our home." 1 year after living in this fancy place, I was asked to join the board and assumed the role of treasurer. While the building was great, the lobby looked tired and dated. I wanted to upgrade the lobby and make it as attractive as the building itself. It would have cost each apartment owner $2,000 for repainting and sprucing it up with some nice furniture. The apartment owners did not approve. They were older and lived in valuable apartments, mostly without mortgages. One could have said that they were rich. However, they did not have the cash to pay for upgrading the lobby, and they also did not want to borrow against their other assets or their apartments. That was when I coined the phrase that they's were rich people who do not have any money. They had no monthly cash flow. We joined the nearby town tennis club, and Jill started playing tennis at that club, and on weekends, also at the country club of Darien. Beginning in 1985, New York University, NYU, invited Jill and me to their annual big gala dinner dances for major donors. In 1984, I had committed to endow a full professorial chair, and the size of the annual donations qualified for Jill and me to be included in those events. I believe it was when I attended this party for the first time in 1985 that NYU had hired a big band and a singer that simulated the Sinatra sound, and that Jill and I danced to the song, "New York, New York." The music electrified our bodies, and we identified with the lyrics. After all, here was Jill, the girl from the tiny Boston suburb of Hull, and me, the boy from little blue-collar Styrum. In other words, in terms of background and geography, we both came from nowhere. And here we were, dancing to a song that could have been written about us. We both had senior jobs with Citibank and Chemical Bank, both top New York banks. I was on Citibank's Market Risk Policy Committee and traveled globally for the bank. In addition, I was part-time professor of finance at New York University and chairman of the New York Federal Reserve Bank's Foreign Exchange Committee. We owned and lived in a wonderful co-op apartment at Sutton Place, one of New York's best residential areas. I was on the board and the treasurer of that co-op. We were members of the town tennis club, just around the corner from Sutton Place. We drove a brand new Mercedes E300. The E model had just been introduced to the USA. The car was garaged just below our tennis club. We spent weekends in a wonderful four-bedroom house in Norwalk, Connecticut, and were members of the country club of Darien.
The above facts and our lifestyle were going through my head when I heard the Sinatra-like voice singing, "Start spreading the news. I am leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap. Start spreading the news. I am leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes are longing to stray, right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep, and find I'm king of the hill, top of the heap.
These little town blues are melting away. I'll make a brand new start of it in old New York. If I can make it there, I'll make it anywhere. It's up to you. New York, New York.
While Jill and I were dancing to that tune and heard the song, we looked into each other's eyes and realized that we indeed had made it. Most important, we were healthy and loved each other. And if we made it there, we could make it anywhere. And we have.
I also remember that at that time, I experienced a deep feeling of gratitude for all the blessings I had received up to that point in my life, and thanked God for them. In the summer of 1986, my son Heinz visited us in New York for a week or so. There are two things I remember from this visit. First, Heinz also had taken up tennis, and he and I played at my town tennis club. On that day, Heinz played exceptionally well, and my 26-year-old son beat his 50-year-old father. This was the only time I lost to Heinz, and I did not know whether I should be proud of my son's performance or disappointed with mine. Second, I remember that Heinz came with me when I visited my optician, Dr. Michael Greenberg, on Lexington Avenue, near Citibank's headquarters, for some small routine repair on my glasses. At that time, Heinz had completed his apprenticeship as an optician in Germany, and I introduced Heinz to Dr. Greenberg as such. Dr. Greenberg was familiar with the German apprenticeship system and the quality people it produced. He instantly liked Heinz and invited him to move to New York and work in his network of stores. At the time, Heinz considered the idea, but decided to stay in Germany. In 1986, Jill graduated from NYU and received her degree as Master of Business Administration, MBA. At her graduation, I was allowed to join her on her graduation march because I was a member of the faculty. We walked hand in hand, which we both enjoyed very much. As time passed, Jill told me that every now and then her mother would warn her not to throw her life away by living with a man 20 years her senior. One Saturday morning, September 8, 1984, Jill and I had been shopping in Manhattan and sat down for lunch at a hamburger place called Yellow Fingers on Lexington and 60th Street. We talked about different things, and at some point, I asked Jill about her mother. Jill said that mother was still worried about us living together. I asked whether mother would be happier if we were married, and Jill said, probably.
At that point I said, then, why don't we get married? We both pulled out our calendars and set December 29th of that year as our date to get married. I have to admit that this was an exceptionally unromantic way to propose. However, what counts are the results, and for over 30 years we have loved each other and are happy.
Here is the birthday letter from Jill's mother, Phyllis Novak.
Dear Heinz, people enter your life and some become a part of it. You entered our family and have become a deep part of it. Your devotion as a husband, your concern and generosity for your children and grandchildren have set you apart. Your generosity and kindness to others, including myself, have made life so much easier. Your children are my children. Your grandchildren are my grandchildren. And, perhaps the best gift of all you have given to me, is the wonderful family I have inherited. I wish for you a nice, pleasant life, with a future that is filled with the joys of living, surrounded by your family and friends. With all my love, Ma.
The wedding was held in the morning at a restaurant called Tiger Lilies in Beacon Hill in Boston. My mother flew in from Germany and gave a brief speech in English that moved everybody to tears. In the afternoon, my mother, Jill, and I caught an overnight Lufthansa flight from Boston to Frankfurt, and from there, my mother connected to Dusseldorf. Jill and I went on to Vienna and the Zacher Hotel for our honeymoon. Our honeymoon night, however, had been most exceptional, possibly unique. Jill and I spent our honeymoon night on that Lufthansa plane with my mother. This exceptional circumstance was recognized by the captain of the flight with a special announcement and champagne. It also may have helped that I was a senator of Lufthansa. We landed in Vienna in the late morning of December 30th and proceeded to the Zacher Hotel. The concierge had precious items for us that I had asked him to obtain. 2 tickets for the operetta Fledermaus in the Vienna State Opera for New Year's Eve, dinner reservations after the show at the Zacher Hotel's famous Rota Bar, including celebrating and welcoming the new year. The tradition at this place is that a few minutes before midnight, each table is provided with champagne and a large supply of small styrofoam balls. The guests throw these balls for fun and as a tease towards other people. This is quite harmless, until some balls inadvertently fall into glasses, absorb some champagne, become heavier, and then feel more like small stones when they hit your head. Suddenly, there were almost fights between tables, and people became more aggressive in their pursuit of the game. Waiters used trays and menus as shields to avoid getting hit by these bullets. 2 tickets to the famous Vienna New Year's concert on New Year's morning at the equally famous concert hall Gesellschaft der Musikfreunde, Company of the Friends of Music. The Vienna New Year's concert is a concert of classical music performed by the Vienna Philharmonic that takes place each year in the morning of New Year's Day in Vienna, Austria. It is regarded by many as the most important classical concert worldwide. In 2017, it was broadcast live around the world to an estimated audience of more than 50 million in 93 countries. Any of those tickets are almost impossible to get, which was true at that time and is even truer today. After collecting all of those above-mentioned precious tickets, Jill and I had lunch on December 30th with the treasurer of Citibank Vienna, who also had a little bit of a medical background before he became a banker. He noticed an inflammation of my right middle finger, probably resulting from a manicure. He felt that a doctor should look at that and arranged for an appointment at a hospital the following morning, December 31st, New Year's Eve. Jill and I went to the appointment, and the doctor decided that the nail of that finger should be surgically removed. The procedure happened right then and there, after the doctor had assured me that I would be capable of enjoyment, genussfähig, that very same evening. Poor Jill sat for hours in the hospital waiting room, very worried about me, and with only limited information provided by the doctors. In the end, the doctors were right. I was able to enjoy show, dinner, and the concert the following morning.
Flying Supersonic Concorde. Between 1978 and 1985, I flew the Concorde at least 10 times, usually between London and New York. The Concorde was a British-French turbojet-powered supersonic passenger jet airliner that was operated from 1976 until 2003. It had a maximum speed over twice the speed of sound at Mach 2.04, 1,534 miles per hour, or 2,469 kilometers per hour at cruise altitude, with seating for 92 to 128 passengers. This plane could cross the Atlantic in a little more than 3 hours. A typical London to New York crossing would take a little less than 3.5 hours,
as opposed to about 8 hours for a subsonic flight. Concorde could fly as high as 60,000 feet, which is an altitude of over 11 miles. From there, at the edge of space, in the layers between the stratosphere and the ionosphere, it was possible for passengers to see the curvature of the Earth. The speed of the plane was electronically displayed in the front of the plane, and it was easy for all passengers to see. Soon after takeoff, the plane would reach a speed of M0.98, or just below the speed of sound, 767 miles per hour. Once the plane was over the ocean, the pilot announced that we would now break the sound barrier and accelerate from M0.98 to more than M2, i.e., more than twice the speed of sound. This created a sonic boom that could not be heard inside the plane, but was disturbingly loud on the ground. This was the reason why the plane was not allowed to travel at M1 speed while it was still over land. A sonic boom is the sound associated with the shock waves created by an object traveling through the air faster than the speed of sound. This moment always impressed me. Here I was sitting comfortably, sipping champagne, and moving almost at the speed of sound. When the acceleration began and the speed doubled from almost M1 to more than M2, I could feel the sensation in my lower back, just as if I was sitting in a powerful sports car accelerating from 30 to 60 miles per hour. A planned route from London to Singapore via Bahrain, operated in conjunction with Singapore Airlines, was cancelled after just 3 return flights due to complaints about noise disturbances caused by the aircraft's sonic boom. Also, Concorde was impeded from flying over Saudi Arabian airspace because it was believed that noise from the aircraft would disturb camel breeding. When flying from London to New York, I saw the sun rise in the west. Repeat, I saw the sun rising in the west. Here is how this was possible. The time difference between London and New York is 5 hours. That is, London is 5 hours ahead of New York. In winter, the plane left London at 6 p.m., at which time it was 1 p.m. in New York. After a 3-hour flight, the plane would land in New York at 4 p.m. New York time. At that time, it was still daylight in New York. This means that after taking off in the dark at 6 p.m. London time, the plane flew towards the west and caught up with the sun. When that sun became visible during the flight, it appeared in front of the plane. As the plane was flying from the east towards the west, the sun appeared on the horizon west of the plane. This means that the sun appeared to rise in the west. Writing and publishing my second book, 1983. Even though a large part of my success in Citibank was inventing and implementing the concept of treasury, my first book was largely about foreign exchange. Therefore, it was appropriately titled Foreign Exchange Markets. It was only natural that I had to write an additional book describing the combination of the foreign exchange business and the money market business. Therefore, this second book was called Foreign Exchange and Money Markets. It was again co-authored by Rita Rodriguez and published by McGraw-Hill in 1983. ISBN 978-007-052671-6. This second book really became the Bible for FX and money market traders around the world. It had all the hallmarks of my expertise in the business, which was pretty complete. But it also had all the hallmarks of effective instruction. after each section in which a particular part of the business is described, there are several problems where the solution and answers require an application of what is covered in the section immediately prior. In this way, students and readers can learn by reading the respective section and immediately thereafter applying what they learned by trying to solve the respective problems. After completing the exercises, they receive immediate feedback by checking the answers that are available right there. In this way, the reader can self-test whether what has been read, and presumably learned, is in fact understood.
This book is known in the industry as the book, and was translated into Chinese, Italian, Japanese, Portuguese, and Spanish. You can see a reference to the book in this birthday letter from James Kemp, FX head of Citibank, New York.
Jill, as you know, Heinz was considered one of the godfathers of foreign exchange, having written the seminal textbook on the subject, and was something of a legendary figure. On one occasion, he was introduced to one of my junior FX traders, who was somewhat awestruck and said, "You're Heinz Real?" Heinz replied, "Yes, I wrote the book." This has always stuck with me, as it spoke volumes about Heinz's stature and reputation in the markets, and the justifiable pride he took in his achievements. He can honestly say he was there at the birth of an industry and helped to shape its future. I have the utmost professional respect for Heinz and have always valued the thoughtful and balanced advice he has given me. Moreover, it has always been delivered with an old-world charm and courtesy that we see far too little of these days. In the most positive sense of the word, he is a gentleman. Sue and I wish him a wonderful birthday celebration and continued health and happiness. Warm regards, James.
More teaching activities. The interest rate and FX derivatives, including options, had to be explained to the Citibank marketing people. As a result, in 1983, I gave up the line responsibility for the trading room and made it my main job to explain all the new derivative products inside Citibank. Inventing concept of third level of understanding. In this context, I learned that it was not good enough to explain something to participants and, when they had no questions at the end, to assume that they had understood it. It was at that time that I developed the concept of third level of understanding. Here it is in language straight from my website, www.realworld.com. When we wish to sell a new product or a new idea to a customer, the subject must be properly explained. Otherwise, there will be no sale. Particularly when we talk to customers, we unfortunately often talk to what I call an assistant wonderful. These are very important people in their organization, like assistant treasurers or deputy managing directors. However, even though they are important in their organization, they can only recommend that something new be done. Before the deal really gets done, these assistant wonderfuls must explain it to their boss. Only when the boss understands will she approve it, and only at that point can the deal be completed. This means that with our explanation to the assistant wonderful, we must enable this assistant wonderful to explain the new idea so well to the boss that the boss understands it. One reason why bosses are bosses is that they will never approve anything they do not understand. There are three levels of understanding, and we must reach the third level. On the first level, you completely understand but cannot explain. This first level is required for bosses, because otherwise there will be no approval and no deal. On the second level, you can explain well enough so that your listener reaches the first level. This second level is required for assistant wonderfuls, so that they can explain to their bosses and enable them to reach the first level. On the third level, you can provide an explanation that is so complete and encompassing that it enables your listener to reach the second level. This third level is required for salespeople, so that they can explain to the assistant wonderfuls and enable them to reach the second level. The assistant wonderfuls need this second level of understanding, so that they, without our help, can successfully explain to their bosses and enable those bosses to reach the first level of understanding. Once bosses understand, they will decide. I helped people to reach that third level of understanding as follows. Every day, I gave 3 90-minute lectures on a given topic or product. 2 such lectures in the morning and 1 in the afternoon after lunch. For the rest of the day, usually beginning around 3 o'clock, I divided the participants into groups of 3 people each. So, if there were 30 participants, I put 3 people at each table for a total of 10 tables. Then each person in the group had a chance to play the following roles. Mr. Experti, who knew it all. Ms. New, who was very smart, but knew nothing about the subject. Mr. Critique, who had to comment on the quality of the explanation given by Mr. Experti. The 3 people would take turns, so that each of them was in the role of Mr. Experti at least once. It was clear that most of the learning was done by Mr. Experti, that is, the person who had to do the talking and explaining. This exercise demonstrated that even though people think they understand, they are not able to explain in an effective way. The afternoon/evening ended when each individual could demonstrate to me personally that they were able to explain something so well that, in my opinion, a person without prior knowledge would be able to understand. With this type of training, the Citibank marketing people began to have much more success in selling the new derivative products to customers.
Assuming role of regional treasurer for Latin America, 1985, age 49. Regional treasurer for Latin America, Jacques Levy, resigned from Citibank to set up his own business in Mexico, and the bank asked me to assume his role. I stayed in New York and manage the trading activities of the 24 Latin countries from New York. The financial markets of those 24 countries varied substantially in size, economic importance, complexity, and sophistication. There were Brazil and Argentina as heavyweights on one side, the likes of Haiti and El Salvador on the other side, and countries like Chile and Mexico in the middle. The size of the individual transactions was much more modest than in Europe or New York. However, because of the regulatory environment, the complexity was so much greater. Later I will discuss volatility, which means the anticipated fluctuation intensity of financial market prices. In Latin America, there was also another type of volatility, which I called regulatory volatility. For example, there were years in which a country like Brazil had more than 500 new regulations issued by the central bank and the Ministry of Finance that impacted the financial markets. The reason for all these regulations was that the governments wanted to prevent businesses from taking money out of their countries. These countries experienced over 10,000% annual inflation and corresponding devaluations of their currencies, and businesses did not want to keep their money there. However, the last thought any businessman would have when a new capital export constraint was announced
was to actually comply with that new rule. The will of the businessmen to continue to take money out of the country, the lack of sophistication and amateurism of the government, and the creativity of banks like Citibank usually assured that the old business would continue as usual. It was in this type of environment that Citibank developed the subtitle Banco de Solución, that is, Bank of Solutions. It was a great business environment with lots of room for creative thinking. As I said before, the transaction amounts were smaller, but the profit margins, as compensation for creative solutions to problems, were bigger. And we made tons of money. The business and traveling to the entire area was fun. From the accelerator to the brakes. Inventing meaningful limits for risks in trading. 1985. When I joined Citibank 25 years earlier, in 1960, at age 25, I taught the bank the treasury business and how to speculate on expected changes in foreign exchange rates and interest rates for its own account, proprietary trading. I taught the marketing people how to apply financial trading, including the new derivative instruments, to customers and help them to solve the related problems. The daily volumes and individual transaction amounts in the world's major currencies were enormous and continued to grow. The daily turnover in foreign exchange topped $5 trillion. That is, trillion, with the first letter being a T, like in Tom. Common sense suggested that it was time to think about how to limit Citibank's proprietary speculative business and also invent internal controls to avoid errors and frauds. Since 1981, traders received bonuses that often were equal to a multiple of their annual base salaries. However, they received those bonuses only if they made more money than the aggressive budgets agreed to with management at the beginning of the year. We don't pay for attendance. Therefore, when it was October and they were still behind in their budget, there was a powerful incentive to take larger risks than they were allowed to per their limits. Also, there were incentives to hide those large risks so that senior management could not see them. It became clear to me that there was a discrepancy between the type and size of risks taken by our traders on one side and the understanding of the trading business and its risks on the other side. The only risk Citibank senior management understood was the risk of lending money to a borrower who subsequently goes broke and fails to pay us back. That risk is known as credit risk. In financial trading, we might buy something at a price of 100, and after that the price goes down to 99. As a result, we have a loss, but nobody went bankrupt. That is known as price risk. At Citibank, and in the trading industry in general, we limited price risk by limiting the amount that a trader could buy of a given commodity, foreign currency, or shares of stock. That was better than no limit at all, but it was not limiting the size of the risk. Instead, it limited the size of the position.
As I began to understand trading options, I also came to see that the important component in calculating an option price is the expected future volatility. When the price of a given commodity is expected to fluctuate widely in the future, then an option on that commodity is more expensive, assuming all other features of the option are the same. And when the price of a given commodity is expected to not fluctuate widely in the future, then an option on that commodity is less expensive, assuming all other features of the option are the same. This can be compared to automobile insurance. An 18-year-old beginning driver is more likely to have accidents than an experienced 40-year-old driver. The risk of insuring the 18-year-old is higher than that of a 40-year-old. Therefore, the insurance premium for the younger driver is higher than for the more experienced driver. It is clear from the above that the volatility in options is a market price driven, like all prices, by supply and demand.
I concluded that these options, implied volatility, can be used to estimate the future fluctuation of prices and rates, including foreign exchange rates, stocks, and interest rates. It occurred to me that this insight and understanding can be used to estimate the size of the risk in, for example, a foreign exchange position. If I have a position of $100 million and the option implied overnight volatility is, for example, 2%, then it could very well be that the market rate will move 2% against me and I will suffer a loss of $2 million, 2% of $100 million. In other words, the above-described technique allowed me to convert meaningless position amounts like $100 million into meaningful estimates of what I called potential loss amounts, PLA. This was major. I had discovered a way to quantify risk in financial trading. Years later, this thought process became industry standard worldwide. The world did not adopt my PLA terminology. Instead, the world called the potential loss amounts value at risk, VAR. That did not make any difference. 2% of $100 million is still $2 million, whether you call it potential loss amount or value at risk. Meanwhile, I worked on developing this new idea further so that it could be used in the management of price risk for a country or a specific dealing room. First, I used VAR to set limits. I decided that, under normal circumstances, a trader should not lose overnight more than the equivalent of 1 month earnings. That means, if a trader has an annual budget of $12 million, it equates to a monthly budget of $1 million. Therefore, the trader's overnight limit should be such that he usually cannot lose more than $1 million overnight. As a result, the position size depends on the expected volatility applied to that VAR limit of $1 million. If the expected volatility is 1%, the trader can take a maximum position of $100 million. Because if the market moves 1% against him, he will lose $1 million. That is too bad, but we were willing to risk $1 million or 1 month budgeted earnings. On the other hand, if the expected volatility is 2%, the trader can take a maximum position of $50 million. Because if the market moves 2% against him, he will again lose $1 million. That is too bad, but we were willing to risk $1 million or 1 month budgeted earnings. It is clear from the above that it doesn't matter how volatile the market is, Citibank has a constant amount of $1 million at risk. The value at risk is constant, and the size of the position is variable, depending on market conditions. Again, this is similar to driving a car. When street conditions are good, we drive faster than when street conditions are volatile, that is not good. Our speed varies, but our perception of the risk of driving is the same, whether it is 10 miles per hour on busy Main Street or 65 miles per hour on the superhighway. Second, I used VAR to perform a risk versus return analysis. Because I was now able to measure the size of risk a trader had taken, I could also quantify and measure the trader's relative performance. For example, take two different traders. Each trader made $10 million in a given period of time. However, Trader A assumed $400,000 of risk every night, and Trader B assumed $800,000 of risk every night. It is clear that the two traders made the same amount of money, but trader A assumed less risk than trader B. Therefore, I can conclude that trader A had a better performance and deserves a higher bonus.
Obviously, my total risk-taking capacity was limited. That is, the total value at risk, VAR, amount allocated to me as regional treasurer for South America by senior management was limited. The system I described above allowed me to allocate the highest VAR limits to traders and countries that squeezed the most earnings out of a given amount of VAR. As I am talking about squeezing, assume that we are in the orange juice business at a time when the juice was still squeezed out of the oranges by hand. There likely were men who could squeeze 2 cups of juice out of an orange and others who could squeeze only 1 cup out of a comparable orange. Obviously, we would hire the better squeezers, that is, the guys who can squeeze 2 cups out of an orange, and not the ones who can squeeze only 1 cup. I applied this limit and control system to all of my 24 countries in Latin America for several years before first Citibank Worldwide and ultimately the entire banking industry began to use it. The most senior group of people in Citibank to control risk was the Credit Policy Committee, which established guidelines and limits. Co-founder of the Market Risk Policy Committee at Citibank, the development of my value at risk system, together with other controls relating to trading, led in 1988 in Citibank to the formation of the Market Risk Policy Committee. I was one of 5 founding members of that committee, representing different geographic areas, with me representing Latin America. Citibank was the first bank in the world to have such a Market Risk Policy Committee, in addition and parallel to a Credit Policy Committee. During my last years in Citibank, I had several outstanding assistants who helped me with administrative work, allowing me more time for my beloved teaching activities. Those assistants included Beatriz Rincon Young from Venezuela and Fernando Botargues from Argentina. They were junior people in the risk management functions of our Caracas and Buenos Aires branches. I liked their style and ability and asked them to come to New York and work for me. Both transfers worked out very well for them and for me. Here is a birthday letter from Beatriz Rincon.
I have so many memories of Heinz that it is hard to select a specific one. Meeting him at the very beginning of my professional life led to, without a doubt, my becoming a confident and gratified adult. Heinz was not only a professional mentor, he was also a protective father figure after my move from Caracas to NYC. To be sure, Heinz did teach me almost everything I know of banking. He believed in me when he pushed me to get my MBA, created scores of opportunities for me, and gave me career advice. The things that I will always remember learning from him, though, are of a different nature. Never stop learning. Always try to achieve the third level of understanding. Work hard. Have fun. Celebrate life. Manage your personal risk. Cross the street when you see thugs coming your way. Read the paper early. You never know who's going to get in the elevator with you. Fight the bully. Gently. Look out for small details. Be on time. Don't forget about family. When Heinz offered me to come work with him in NYC, a couple of people cautioned me and tried to deter me from accepting. Heinz had a reputation of being a very tough, difficult, and intimidating boss, and we all know he can be, at times, brutally honest, which, strangely enough, was one of his qualities that I learnt to rely on. Knowing the risks, I accepted the job and moved to NYC, and learnt the most important lesson of all. Some risks are worth taking. Just make sure you understand it. Heinz, I know you took a risk on me too, and I thank you for believing in me. I can only hope that I've made you proud, like Eliza with Professor Higgins. Happy 70th birthday.
Bodyguards. From the time I left Citibank Germany in 1970 to work for the bank's headquarters in New York until my retirement at the end of 1995, I traveled globally, covering all five continents. Even though I had a German passport, my appearance and demeanor, plus the fact that I worked for an American company, made me look very much like an American. I actually became a citizen of the United States in 1999 after I retired from Citibank. Inside Citibank, it did not make any difference what I looked like and what nationality passport I had. However, Americans were a little more at risk than other international travelers. Particularly, there was a risk that Americans would be kidnapped. In fact, I knew that the bank had insurance for potential ransom payments to free their senior officers. No employee knew whether he or she was on that list, but, given my seniority in the bank and my frequency of traveling to exposed areas, I was pretty sure that I was on that list. More importantly, any criminal would assume that a person of my seniority would be on such a list. I actually experienced three specific situations in which I knew that I was covered by a Citibank bodyguard. All three occurred when I covered South America during my last 10 years in the bank, from 1985 to 1995. In the late 1980s, I traveled to Buenos Aires for a budget meeting. I arrived on a Saturday for the meeting to be held on a Sunday. The treasurer, Bobby Gamara, wanted his senior traders to present their budget directly to me so that I could get to know them, which was the reason for the meeting on a Sunday, so that the traders were not away from their desks during trading on business days. There were not many people in the bank on that Sunday, except those involved in the budget presentations. I did not know many of those traders, which embarrassed me a little, because I wanted them to know that I knew them. At one point, I went to the bathroom, and I noticed that another man was with me there. I remembered that I had seen this man several times before. In fact, he was one of several guys, along with my treasurer Bobby Gamara, who had picked me up at the airport the previous day. As we were alone in the bathroom, I asked him his name and what his specific job was in the Treasury Department of Citibank Buenos Aires. "I am one of your bodyguards," was his answer. I was surprised by his answer, and not sure whether I should be glad or worried. Nothing happened. The second involvement with a bodyguard occurred in Bogota, Colombia. Around 1990, Citibank Bogota had a very serious problem with the Central Bank of Colombia. It was a big mess that had to be sorted out. As regional treasurer for South America, it was my responsibility to handle this situation in person, and I had to travel to Bogota. As regional treasurer, I could go into any of my 24 countries at any time to review Citibank's trading business. I did not need permission from the respective country's manager for such visits. I would only inform them that I was coming for a couple of days. This was different with Bogota. The situation in Colombia was so dangerous that the country manager had to approve in advance when a senior person from Citibank New York wanted to visit. He would only approve if indeed there was an urgent need for such a high-profile person to visit. It was costly and burdensome for Citibank in Bogota to effectively protect these types of visitors. Needless to say, the country manager approved my visit. My wife Jill knew about the danger of kidnappings in Bogota, and she was opposed to my going there. However, I had to go. It was part of my job. I was afraid to tell her. I called her father, Marvin, explained the situation. He talked to Jill, and she let me go. In Bogota, I was met at the airport, at the foot of the plane, by a Citibank car. It was a specially armored Mercedes, which had been made safe for $600,000 with special steel plates, etc. In the car was my special bodyguard, who had been the chief of Bogota police until 1 week prior. I stayed at the Bogota Hilton Hotel for 3 days, during which I never left my room. There were two heavily armed guards outside my room around the clock. All the Citibank employees I had to talk to came from the branch to my hotel room for interviews. I returned to the airport and onto the plane with the same automobile and escorted by the same senior bodyguard as upon my arrival. Nothing happened, but it was quite an experience.
My scariest experience was in Mexico City in the early 1990s. I was there on a routine visit for a few days, a couple of months before our country manager had been kidnapped, but reappeared again after 2 days. My local treasurer took me to lunch in a bank car with a bodyguard sitting next to the driver in the front seat. My trader and I sat in the back. Suddenly, the bodyguard announced that he had a feeling we were being followed. He took out his gun and cocked it. He instructed the driver to take turns different from those needed to go to the restaurant. The bodyguard instructed us to duck down in the back of the car so that we were less visible. For the first 5 turns or so, the suspicious car behind us followed us. Then the bodyguard announced that the car was no longer following us and the situation was back to normal. Again, nothing happened, but my trader and I needed a couple of stiff drinks when we arrived at the restaurant. I am sure the bank had bodyguards for me often when I traveled in South America, and I did not even know about it. Personal life. Until I retired from Citibank at the end of 1995, Tango Show in Buenos Aires. In the late 1980s, I took Jill along on one of my trips to Buenos Aires, Argentina. As regional treasurer for South America, it was my job to visit frequently this very important country to review the treasury operations of the Citibank branch. I always wanted to see a real, typical Argentinian tango show, and as Jill was with me, I thought this was the time to do so. Like all social activities, dinner and the show began late, around 11 o'clock in the evening. The Citibank driver took us to a very dark street where the place was located and waited for us. It was a wonderful experience, and at around 2:30 a.m., the driver took us back to our hotel. In Buenos Aires, I always stayed at the Plaza Hotel, one of the best hotels in town. Jill and I went through the lobby to the elevators, and while we were waiting for the elevator, I embraced Jill and gave her a little kiss. Soon thereafter, a gentleman from the reception desk approached and asked me to follow him a few steps away. Then he told me, "Sorry, sir, but we are not that kind of a hotel." I advised him that the lady was my wife and gave him my room number. He went to check his record and my registration and apologized. Jill and I had a good laugh, and I was proud of my attractive wife. Joining Deutsche Verein, which is in New York. In the late 1980s, Jill and I joined the German Club in New York. The club met every month in the premises of the Union Club of the City of New York, located at 101 East 69th Street and Park Avenue. President Reinhard Augustin and wife Helmi always created a festive German ambiance, including singing of German songs. Traditionally, there was a cocktail party followed by a sit-down dinner and a prominent speaker from German industry or politics. The photo shows my good friend Stefan Bub, at that time head of the New York office of Hypo Vereinsbank, Munich, seated between Jill and myself. At Stefan's invitation, I joined his bank's advisory board at the Munich headquarters for several years. That board held quarterly meetings in very attractive locations all over Europe.
For several years, I was quite active in the Deutsche Verein, joining the board and serving as treasurer. I also served 1 year as Santa Claus at the Christmas party, and I played a major role in allowing for the first time a lady to become a member in her own name. Jill, celebrating Hanukkah. The joyous festival of Hanukkah begins on the 25th of Kislev on the Jewish calendar, which often occurs in December near Christmas. It celebrates two miracles, a great Jewish military victory and the miraculous supply of oil for the temple. Hanukkah, also called the Festival of Lights, is celebrated for 8 days. The Hanukkah menorah holds 9 candles, one for each of the 8 nights, and an additional candle that is used to light the others. 1 candle is lit on the first night, 2 on the second night, until all 8 candles are lit on the 8th night. Hanukkah is a time to celebrate with family and friends, to eat holiday treats, and to give gifts, especially to children. Jill always lighting Hanukkah candles. After lighting the candles, she would say the following prayer in Hebrew. Blessed are you, Lord, our God, sovereign of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us, who performed miracles for our ancestors in those days at this time, who has kept us alive, sustained us, and enabled us to reach this season and light the lights of Hanukkah. Amen.
I always encourage Jill to practice this important Jewish tradition and enjoyed silently praying with her. Needless to say, Jill always actively participated and supported our Christmas celebrations, which included decorating a tree, wrapping and distributing presents, and cooking a delicious Christmas goose. Norwalk House, Jill made some good career moves and ultimately became a director at Barclays Bank in New York with global responsibility for dollar-denominated interest rate options. Together, we made good money and in 1986 decided to buy a weekend place in Connecticut. As I mentioned before, we found a nice house in Norwalk on a street called Cottontail. The house had 4 bedrooms and a nice garden with a pool. There was plenty of space for Janine, occasionally Ralph, as well as other family and friends to visit and stay. It also was in walking distance of the Rowayton Railroad Station, if we decided to take the train to New York. Around that time, I also bought a nice 300E Mercedes, one of the first E-Class models in the USA. It was brand new, and I personally drove it out of the Mercedes showroom on Park Avenue at 56th Street. I got a space to park the car only 1 block away from our Sutton Place apartment. The spot inside the garage was such that I could park it in that spot myself, so that no attendant had to touch or drive the car. The car was my baby, and this was important to me at the time. Tennis in the 1980s. In the tennis department, one of the staff supporting foreign exchange trading at Citibank New York in the 1980s was a member of the Wall Street Racquet Club. I played with him frequently after office hours and had a lot of fun there. I loved the logo of the club. It shows a bear and a bull facing each other across the tennis net, as is the case in the financial markets every day. If a person is optimistic and believes that stocks will go up, he or she is called a bull and is said to have a bullish outlook. A bear market is when the economy is bad, recession is looming, and stock prices are falling. Bear markets make it tough for investors to pick profitable stocks. The origin for this idiomatic expression is as follows. A bull attacks and derives his power by lowering his head
and throwing his prey into the air. The target is disoriented upon crashing down on the ground, at which time the bull can kill it. In other words, the bull benefits from an upward movement. A bear attacks and derives his power by rising to his hind feet and coming down on his prey. That is, he benefits from a downward movement. I remember very well winning the Lufthansa Horn Cup at the Senator tournament in 1988, when I was age 52. Lufthansa had invited all its senators of the U.S. East Coast, from Boston to Washington, D.C. Altogether, some 65 men. I made it to the final against a much younger German man who was the U.S. finance director of the German multinational company Degussa. In the final set, I repeatedly had match points, but could not win the point when I was serving on the ad side, that is, the left side of the court. I saw in my mind that beautiful trophy and wanted it so badly. I finally prayed to God and said, "God, I want to win this. Please help me. But it has to be right now, because I cannot run any more. I promise to donate $1,000 to the Red Cross if I win. But God, it must be now." I served, and the other guy hits a ball into the net. I won the trophy, and I donated $1,000 as my part of the bargain. Today, I consider it inappropriate to ask God for help in a tennis situation. But anyway, that is what happened in 1988. A couple of days earlier, when I was still traveling in Mexico, Jill had been promoted to vice president at Chemical Bank. I called Elsie Rivas, my beautiful, long-legged Puerto Rican secretary, to get a big bottle of champagne from my Sutton Place wine store, where I had an account. She asked, "Mr. Real, what do you mean when you say a big bottle of champagne?" And I said, "It must reach your kneecaps when you are in high heels." She ordered what turned out to be a Salmanazar, which is equivalent to 12 standard bottles of champagne. When I returned from Mexico and went to the wine shop to get it, I needed help from a young man in the store to carry the bottle the 400 yards to my Sutton Place apartment. We celebrated Jill's promotion and my winning the Lufthansa Senator tournament, and we still have that bottle as a souvenir. Obviously, we had help from some friends to finish the champagne. This was consistent with one of my mother's many proverbs. Success counts double when good friends share it with you.
My daughter Janine's personal evolution and successes. Once we had the Norwalk house, Janine came to visit us frequently from Knox. For the last few years before she got her high school degree there in 1988, Jill and I picked her up for weekends, either at the school or, when she came by train, at the Penn Station in New York. In 1989, after a year at Pine Manor College in Boston, Janine went to Mount Bachelor Academy in Prineville, Oregon, which was a private co-educational therapeutic boarding school. Together with education advisor Dr. Morse, Jill had identified this school as a perfect, almost summer camp-like place for Janine. The place was extremely expensive, but we still decided to let Janine go there for July and August because we were convinced that this would be good for her. After Janine had been there for a few weeks, she called asking us to let her stay at that school for an entire year. There were tears on the phone, and the head of the school got involved, assuring and convincing me that it would be very good for Janine to stay there for a complete year. Finally, I was convinced and agreed. However,
This was so important for both Janine and me that I told the headmaster that I personally wanted to tell Janine about my decision to leave her at the school for a year. I flew out to this right in the middle of nowhere place via San Francisco to Bend, Oregon, rented a car for another 2-hour drive, and finally arrived at the school. It was all worth it. I will never forget the moment when I held my daughter in my arms, looked into her eyes, and told her that she could go on and stay at the school for the whole year. Janine was so successful at Mount Bachelor Academy that at the end of the year, the school offered to have her stay on as a teacher. Again, she was very successful, so that after some time, she was put in charge of the Academy Middle School. It was also at this school that Janine found the love and man of her life. It was David LePere, the wilderness director of the school. David is a wonderful man. I remember vividly in 1994 when he telephoned me halfway around the world in Jakarta, Indonesia, asking for the hand in marriage of my daughter Janine. They are happily married, and I am very proud of their 3 boys, Riley, Cole, and Dylan, who were born in 2001, 2004, and 2006, respectively. David is executive director of the therapeutic Cherokee Creek Boys School in Westminster, South Carolina. Janine was not the first to give me grandchildren. My son Heinz in Germany also got married, and in 1992 had 2 boys named Alexander and Nikolai. Heinz passed the famous German apprenticeship as an optician, and after that became a master optician. After an additional year of full-time schooling, Heinz also became a master of acoustics. He lives with his life partner Regina in Essen near Düsseldorf and owns several stores in that area. Nikolai and Alexander are both working in their father's stores, also learning, as apprentices, the crafts and business of optics and acoustics. For Jill and me, the weekend routine was that I drove our car from Sutton Place on 57th Street to the subway station at Lexington and 86th Street. When Jill arrived by subway from Wall Street, she came into the car and we drove the 30 miles to our house in Norwalk, Connecticut. Sometimes the ride was slow because of heavy traffic, but we would hold hands and say, "Never mind, we are together." On Monday mornings, we got up at 5:30 and left early, around 6:30. I drove Jill all the way down to Wall Street and dropped her at her office not later than 7:45. After that, I drove back to Midtown to the Sutton Place area to park the car and walk to my office.
Taking up golf in 1993. Once we began spending weekends in the Norwalk house, we also began to make more use of the country club of Darien, including playing tennis. However, playing tennis with Jill was not so great. She hit the balls all over the place, and I ran all over the place to get the balls back in front of her. It was good exercise, but not really fun. Then at some club party, somebody suggested that we both take up golf where we both would be beginners. Also, in golf, a skill differential between 2 people is not as disturbing as it is in tennis. We applied in 1990 to upgrade our membership from tennis to golf and were told that we had to wait an estimated 3 years. During that waiting period, we played golf on weekends on public courses in the area. I believe that it was around 1993 when we finally became full golf members of the Country Club of Darien. At the beginning, my golf was better than Jill's because of the hand-to-eye coordination I had from tennis. But things changed quickly because Jill worked on her golf and I did not. My handicap never went lower than 20,
and Jill's went way lower than that. When there were club championships at the country club of Darien, Jill inquired about the handicap of the ladies' champion. When she heard that it was 12, she immediately announced that she would be a 12 one day in the future. Well, her handicap went even lower than that, to the single-digit level. She has, so far, won the club championship 7 times, including in 2018 in our Linville Ridge Club in North Carolina, and twice in Jupiter, Florida, in Admiral's Cove. I remember the day in the late 1990s when I heard that Jill had broken 100 for the first time since she took up golf. She was on the terrace of the country club of Darien, and I sent champagne for Jill and all her friends to celebrate. Teaching. Until I retired at the end of 1995, until the mid to late 1980s, the focus of my teaching was on explaining all aspects of the foreign exchange and money market business. That teaching activity changed dramatically with my discovery of the value-at-risk system and other risk management and internal control concepts. Initially, larger and larger parts of my seminars and training courses were focused on risk management. Finally, I divided my material and created 2 separate courses. One course I called International Treasury Management, in which I described the basic business of foreign exchange and money markets. The other one I called Treasury Risk Management, in which I described how to control the price, counterparty credit, and liquidity risks in the business, as well as the internal controls used to protect against errors and fraud. Not surprisingly, most audiences very quickly became more interested in my courses in risk management and controls than in the basics of treasury. By now, the basics had been around since I discovered them in 1960, and were known for almost 30 years. There were also more people who could teach the basic material. On the other hand, treasury risk management was brand new, and many people were interested in that. My Asian clients, that is, the central bank-sponsored banking schools in Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and Jakarta, Indonesia, all switched my regular annual courses from basic treasury to treasury risk management. One of my oldest customers is what is now known as the Asian Banking School, arm of Bank Negara, Kuala Lumpur, Central Bank of Malaysia. Their bank inspectors attended my public seminars organized by this Asian Banking School of Malaysia. They liked what they heard and invited me to teach in their own staff training center. The Malaysian banks knew that I was teaching the inspectors of the central bank who periodically came into their banks to inspect them and make sure that they were doing all the right things. Therefore, the Malaysian bankers came to my public seminars to hear what I had to say, and I would tell them to do this and that, because that is what the inspectors of the central bank will look for when they come next to your bank. For example, I told the inspectors of the central bank to assure that the commercial banks had product programs, and I told the staff of the commercial banks attending my public seminars to make sure that they had those product programs in place, because the central bank inspectors would look for them. It was a circular situation that was just wonderful marketing for me.
In 1 year, while teaching a public seminar in Kota Kinabalu in Malaysia's state of Sabah, I observed Ramadan for 1 week with a group of Malaysian friends. Ramadan is the 9th month in the Islamic calendar. According to Islamic belief, it is a period of fasting for Muslims to commemorate the first revelation of the Quran to Muhammad. The fasting period lasts 29 to 30 days based on the visual sightings of the crescent moon. While fasting from dawn until sunset, Muslims refrain from consuming food, drinking liquids, and smoking. At the end of the fasting period, there is the celebration of Eid al-Fitr, also known as Hari Raya, which is a great celebration, often lasting 3 days. Risk management became very popular virtually overnight. Just as 30 years earlier,
the financial world adopted my treasury concept, now everybody wanted to learn more about risk management and internal controls. My treasury risk management course at New York University, NYU, was so popular that there usually were more people signed up for the course than there were chairs in the classroom. Rather than sending students back home, I went into the adjacent classrooms and moved chairs from those into mine. However, the administration found out about it because they saw that there were more students registered in my class than my classroom could legally hold from a fire hazard viewpoint. They allowed me to finish the ongoing class, but told me not to do that again for future semesters. In another year, the following major problem developed. Because of my global travel and commitments at Citibank, I usually could not teach 14 consecutive Tuesday nights as required by the published schedule. Therefore, there would usually be one or two makeup classes scheduled for Friday nights in lieu of Tuesday. I announced those changes on the first day of class so that students could plan accordingly. There came a situation when my class was again oversubscribed, so that there were some 10 students standing and waiting to possibly still be admitted to my class. When I announced that there would have to be 2 makeup classes on Friday nights, there were 3 students who told me that they are Jewish and that their religion does not allow them to do any work after sunset on Fridays, including attending a class. I saw the waiting students who wanted to get into my class and decided that the 3 Jewish students simply could not take my class this time around and would be replaced by 3 students on the waiting list who were able to attend on Friday nights. A few days later, I received a phone call from my friend Jerry Lieberman, who was the head of all Citibank human resources. He told me that he had received a letter from another Citibank employee who was a student in my class and had witnessed my behavior and decisions last Tuesday evening. This gentleman wrote in his letter that he was embarrassed and ashamed to witness how a fellow Citibanker, in a rude way and with a Nazi-type German accent, fired the 3 Jewish students from his class and replaced them with non-Jewish students. It took me a moment until I fully understood what Jerry Lieberman, who is Jewish, was telling me. He said, "Heinz, if you do not take dramatic corrective action, you will be in deep shit." I believed him. I telephoned each one of the 3 students, apologized, and set up makeup classes just for those 3 guys for each one of the 14 classes at a time that was convenient for them. Also, at the evening of the next class, I apologized to the entire class for my behavior. I used language like serious error in judgment, etc. This situation easily could have turned ugly, but I was lucky to have Jerry Lieberman for a friend. Earlier in his career, he had worked in the Latin America division, where I was still working at that time. Jerry and his wife also knew Jill and had been our guests for dinner at our Sutton Place apartment.
INSEAD in Fontainebleau, France. My friend Ingo Walter from NYU invited me to help design a 2-week risk management course for INSEAD in Fontainebleau, just 40 miles outside Paris, France. Fontainebleau is a picturesque French town steeped in history and named after the fresh water spring that gave rise to it. It is a name that immediately conjures up images of the forest and castle. INSEAD is an acronym for the French Institut Européen d'Administration des Affaires, or European Institute of Business Administration. INSEAD is a leading business school in Europe. I helped design the course, and every year from about 1990 until 2004,
I taught 2.5 days of the 2-week seminar. I always looked forward to that visit in May of each year. Jill often came with me. The participants were very senior finance people from all around Europe, banks, central banks, and non-financial institutions. Some of them would invite me for private seminars inside their respective organizations. This was true for Finland's Bank, Helsinki, Central Bank of Finland, and Abbey National, London, a British savings bank. One story about INSEAD I will never forget. The flights from the US always arrive in Europe in the morning. The INSEAD car had taken me to my hotel in Fontainebleau, where I arrived at about 10 o'clock in the morning. My hotel room was not yet available, so I sat just outside of the hotel at a little coffee shop. It seemed that the place was not yet open, so I just sat there in the sun, marveling at the beautiful day, the sun, and the flowers everywhere. Suddenly, a waitress, possibly the owner of the place, appeared and asked whether I wanted anything. I explained that I was just waiting for my room in the hotel next door to become available, and that I did not need anything. But then, on second thought, I said, "Well, I am in France. Maybe I should have a glass of champagne. Or is it too early for champagne?" The lady answered right away, "Mais monsieur, in France, it is never too early for champagne." So, I had a glass or two. I never forgot that story. Jill and I usually took a vacation the week following INSEAD and went somewhere else in France. Those trips included the beaches of Normandy, where on June 6, 1944, troops from the USA and England stormed the coast from the sea and accelerated the end of the Second World War. Another time, we toured Alsace, including Strasbourg, with all its gastronomic pleasures. We also toured at length, and on different occasions, Burgundy and Provence, including Marseille. We made a special effort to get to a specific restaurant in Marseille, because at that time, it was world-renowned for its bouillabaisse, the famous fish soup. When we arrived, we were told that on that day, there would not be any bouillabaisse. When the chef went to the market on that morning, he found that the quality of the fish was not up to his standards, so he did not buy any fish and did not mix the soup on that day. In the early 1990s, Jill and I had wine glasses at home, but we were not totally happy with them. Therefore, we were always on the lookout for the perfect glasses. One evening, we had dinner at the restaurant Bas Bro in Barbizon near Fontainebleau and saw red wine served in beautiful glasses at a nearby table. In those days, we both preferred to drink white wine. However, in order to drink from those wonderful glasses, we ordered red wine. We were disappointed when the waiter served our red wine in different glasses, which we found less attractive. We asked the waiter why he used different glasses for our wine as opposed to the other table. "Mais monsieur," he explained, "the people at the other table are drinking Burgundy. You ordered wine from Bordeaux." We bought 8 glasses for Burgundy at that restaurant and took them home. While traveling in France, we spent several days at hotel restaurant La Côte d'Or in Saulieu, in the heart of Burgundy. The owner, Bernard Loiseau, knew that I was a vice president at Citibank in New York and provided what we thought was extra outstanding service. That restaurant had fantastic glasses for red wine, white wine, and champagne. When I asked Bernard about those glasses, it turned out that they did not exist commercially because they had been specially designed for his restaurant by a crystallerie in Alsace. At that time, Bernard was trying to get a 3rd star for his restaurant from the Michelin Guide. He suggested that I write on my Citibank New York official stationery a complimentary letter to the headquarters of that Michelin organization praising his restaurant. In turn, he would permit the Alsace Crystallerie to sell to us his glasses. The entire deal worked out well. I wrote the letter, Bernard got his 3rd star, and Jill and I got beautiful and well-priced glasses shipped to our Sutton Place address in New York.
The glasses even had our JHR monogram on them, and we have those glasses to this day.
Another story that sticks in my mind occurred at a dinner attended by Ingo Walter and his wife, another INSEAD professor and his wife, and my mother and me. All six of us spoke German fluently. After a few bottles of wine, a discussion arose about the difference in meaning between the two German words anspitzen and scharf machen. After some time, my mother asked one of the other ladies, "Do you know what they are talking about?" And the lady answered, "Ja sicher, mach ich doch jeden Abend." "Sure, I do that every evening." Sorry for the people not speaking German, but this is not translatable. In 1992, while I was teaching at INSEAD, one of the professor's wives had an exhibition of her paintings. Her name was Heidi Story. She was an Austrian baroness. I liked one of her paintings so much that I bought it as a present for Jill. It is called Le Printemps, The Sacre du Printemps. Spring, The Rites of Spring. This painting hangs in a prominent spot in our dining room. Jill and I love the text at the bottom of the painting, the following below. Du bist die Freude mir im Leben. Du bist der stete Sonnenschein. Du bist Geschenk von Gott gegeben. Die Harmonie im Herze mein. You are my love, my inspiration, my joy, my fun, my laughter, dear. You chase my sorrows, calm my fear. Your arms around make me feel safe and warm. Nobody will bother me nor harm. So come and stay with me forever. Henceforth, let's love and dance. Love dance together. Carlo Jeneri was a very senior officer of the Finnish Central Bank in Helsinki. He attended my INSEAD seminar in the late 1990s and liked it so much that he invited me to give the same seminar in Helsinki to the inspectors of the Finnish Central Bank. Here is the birthday letter from Carlo Jeneri.
Sometime in the early 1990s, I participated in a course on risk management in banking at INSEAD, the famous institution for management, etc., in Fontainebleau in France. This dullest and most technical of subjects is not something that one would expect to find exciting. So my expectations of the course were that it would be very high standard, professionally very useful, but humourless labouring with technical details and monotonous lecturing from dull academians. To my great positive surprise, things turned out very differently on the last point. It was not boring, not humourless, and not even too technically laborious. The lecturers were all of the highest quality you can find on this planet, and they all could share their knowledge with others in an enthusiastic way that made it easy to learn and appreciate new aspects in the intricacies of risk management in the global financial market. One of the lecturers, however, outshone all the others in his dedicated, even flamboyant, entertaining and extremely educating style. He made it fun to learn about how options are priced and how different derivatives products can affect your risk portfolio, and how responsible and professional risk management should be run. That person was, you guessed right, Heinz Rühl. This jovial, atypical, but also typical at the same time, German with American manners and figure of speech. It was somehow just incredible that someone could make a subject like risk management and derivatives pricing interesting, even sexy. After my return from the course to my job, at that time the head of financial markets department at the Finnish Central Bank, the Bank of Finland, I soon contacted Heinz to find out whether he would be interested in giving a course on risk management at the bank. He agreed, and since then he did numerous courses at the bank and also in the Financial Supervision Authority, to which I had been nominated as Director General in 1996. I know that he also got clients also from the private sector in Finland, as his reputation moved from mouth to mouth. This led to frequent opportunities for me to meet with Heinz, and we soon became good friends. I learned about his childhood in the war-ravaged Germany and the life of their family in the bakery business, how he by chance got employed by Citibank in Germany, and how this led to his outstanding career in the headquarters in New York. He got to know my wife, Hilke, and visited our home. We met his wonderful mother, whom he had taken along for a trip to Finland. And then we, of course, met with his glamorous wife, Jill, a lady of outstanding qualities and professional skills matching Heinz's. While in New York on a visit with my son, Julius, Jill and Heinz invited us to their beautiful home in Connecticut, the word he taught us how to pronounce, for a magnificent Thanksgiving dinner, even if it was not Thanksgiving Day. He and Jill were marvelous hosts, and Julius was most impressed by the limousine service that Heinz had arranged to transport us from and to our hotel in Manhattan. My oldest child, Jenny, also got the benefit of enjoying Heinz's hospitality, although indirectly. When in Georgia as an exchange student, she, when visiting New York at a time that Jill and Heinz were out of town, was entertained by Heinz's son and his friends. Jenny was most impressed and felt embarrassed that she was not allowed to pay for any of the food or other expenses when going out with them into fancy places. She was somewhat relieved when she was told that the expenses were on Heinz and not the young people. So on Jenny's behalf, I thank Heinz for that. There are more things I could tell about Heinz and what an outstanding person he is, but I better stop here so as to make room for others to praise him. Good luck, many happy returns on your 70 Geburtstag, Heinz mein Freund, Carlo and Hilke, January.
Abbey National in London also became a consulting customer because one of the Abbey National people liked what he heard from me at INSEAD. Once I was asked to perform one such consultation in London on a Friday, but the scheduling was a little tight. Here is how it worked. In that week, I taught 4 days from Monday through Thursday at the IBF in Singapore. I then got on a plane on Thursday evening and flew non-stop from Singapore to London, arriving in London at 6 o'clock in the morning. I went to my hotel, took a shower, cold at the end, and reported at 9 o'clock that morning for my consultation at Abbey National. Those were the days when I was young. Temptation to leave Citibank in 1991. One participant in the 1990 INSEAD seminar was a very senior person from Deutsche Bank's headquarters in Frankfurt. He liked my presentation on risk management so much that he offered me a job in his bank. Specifically, he wanted me to be president and CEO of Deutsche Bank in the USA, located in New York. This was a very big job, and I was interested. Citibank had just come out of a big crisis and survived largely because of a multi-billion dollar, equal to 4.9%, equity investment received from Saudi Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal. Deutsche Bank's seniors in Frankfurt had already approved that I be hired for that job. The only thing left was for me to meet the bank's New York management, who had to work for me as per the intended arrangement. My appointment with Deutsche Bank's New York seniors was on a very hot day in August on the west side of 50th Street. Under no circumstances did I want to be late for that appointment, and therefore arrived in Manhattan some 30 minutes early. I was standing on 5th Avenue and 50th Street, right in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral, and decided to go into the church to escape the heat and to sit down and pray. I thanked God for the day
and the potential opportunity with Deutsche Bank. As I heard myself pray, "God, help me to get that job," I stopped and thought about it and corrected my prayer. Instead, I prayed, "God, grant whatever you think is best for me and not what I want. I will stay in Citibank if you think that is best for me." I did not get the job at Deutsche Bank and stayed in Citibank. It turned out that those final 4 years in Citibank from 1992 to 1995 were some of my best years in terms of responsibility, fun, professional fulfillment, and financial benefits. On the other hand, the situation of Deutsche Bank deteriorated. The bank got into big trouble, and I would not have been happy there. Since that time, 25 years ago, whenever I have faced decisions and choices, I have asked God in prayer to grant what He thinks is best for me. Wirtschaftsuniversität in Vienna, Austria. Around the middle 1980s, I was seeking and found contact to the Wirtschaftsuniversität, University for Economics, in Vienna. I got to know Dr. Oskar Menel, who was very temperamental and entrepreneurial. His German nickname was Kugelblitz, meaning something like lightning ball. He was in charge of publishing books for authors who were connected with the university. He expanded this and got the authors of books to also give executive seminars at the university. So he went in both directions. He turned authors into lecturers and lecturers into authors. He began to organize my seminars in Vienna. He called them top seminars and held them in the prestigious Imperial Hotel. Here is the birthday letter from Dr. Oskar Menel, publisher at Vienna University, Austria.
For me, Heinz was one of the first top leaders of whom I was convinced that they had a built-in nuclear-powered battery. Prior to meeting Heinz, I had never known anybody who provided entertainment with such engine-like vitality from early morning until late evening, in both his professional field as well as socially. His reservoir and variety of proverbs and stories almost make him eligible for the Guinness Book of Records. Unfortunately, I cannot easily remember those mental lightnings. However, one of Heinz's sayings always made me look good among my friends, even though I never paid Heinz any royalties or copyright fees for it. Oh, how refreshing and rejuvenating to make love once in an evening. However, even more nice, make love in one evening, twice. A world of such values, together with a charming and sophisticated wife like Jill, is probably the fountain of eternal youth for our great idol, Heinz Riehl. Many thanks for the various activities you performed for several Austrian institutions, which I had the pleasure to organise. Our best wishes for this round birthday. For the next decades, we wish you good health and lots of fun. Your friends, Oskar and Evelyn.
One of the participants in my seminar came from my client Österreichische Länderbank, one of the bigger banks in Austria. His name was Peter Fischer, and he was the treasurer of that bank. He, in turn, invited me to give my seminar in his bank for his top management, which was successful and repeated several times. Attending Vienna Opera Ball in 1987, I had heard of the famous Vienna Opera Ball, which was the number one social event of the entire season in all of Vienna. The ball takes place in the building of the Vienna State Opera on the Thursday preceding Ash Wednesday. Together with the New Year concert, the ball is one of the highlights of the Viennese carnival season, with the heads of Austrian state and government, the political and industrial elite, members of high society, and their guests attending. With the help of Peter Fischer and his bank,
Jill and I got tickets for that ball in 1987. My mother gave as a gift for Jill to have a gown custom made for that ball. We had heard that the marching rule was, the more extravagant, the better. We found a tailor in Greenwich, Connecticut to make the dress. I remember that during the fittings, I sat in a nearby chair, always encouraging the tailor to let Jill show more décolleté. In fact, I had a current photo of Liz Taylor, on which she had it all out, and I said, that is what I want. Well, she did not copy Liz Taylor, but Jill looked gorgeous and sexy. On the night of the ball, we first dined at the Hotel Zacca, where we always stayed when we were in Vienna. Even though it was February and bitter cold, Jill did not need a coat when she ran just across the street to the Vienna State Opera, where the Vienna Opera Ball is always held. It was a grandiose atmosphere. There were many famous people from film, business, and politics, including the German politician and vice chancellor Franz Josef Strauss. It is tradition that the Austrian president opens the ball and introduces that year's debutantes to the public. The dance floor had been built covering the entire orchestra seating area at the level of the stage. It was huge. There were two big bands, one on either side of this huge oval dance floor. They took turns in playing waltz music, so one could waltz non-stop if one had the stamina. In another year, we attended the Zacca House Ball, that is, the House Ball of the Zacca Hotel. It was another spectacular event.